How good is
Committee on Health and Human Services Finance will come to order. We do have a quorum present. Do I have a motion to move to approve the minutes for March 14, 2017?
Mr. Chair, I'd move the minutes.
Representative Pearson moves approval of the minutes for March 14, 2017. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The minutes are adopted. Let's see. First up, Representative Scott moves House File 1362, be later for possible inclusion in our Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. There are no amendments. Representative Scott, I will move the 1362 be before us and to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for hearing House File 1362. Large numbers of children are born to unmarried parents, over 40% nationally and over 30% in Minnesota. This is a concern for public policy because the children of unmarried parents are at an increased risk of wide range of negative psychological, social, educational, and economic outcomes. For example, the children of unmarried parents are more than three times as likely to drop out of high school. Daughters of unmarried parents are more than three times as likely to have teenage pregnancy than the children of married parents. Moreover, the number of unmarried parents are much higher for parents at lower educational and income levels, which means the children of unmarried parents often face the burdens of poverty as well as the risks for unmarried parents. Fortunately, research shows that these risks can be reduced if the parents work together in a co-parenting relationship and if the non-custodial parent has a quality relationship with the child. And with me today are some folks from North Point Health and Wellness. I don't know, was there anything in their packets about you guys? No? Okay. If you need more information, I've got all the information that you might need. North Point is in some need of some financial aid. They were under a federal grant, and that grant has ended. And they're in need of financial support to continue their co-parenting courses to help, and this money would help them provide assistance to replicate this important work in Hennepin County and hopefully to replicate that in other counties as well. This will provide $200,000 per year for the next 2 years to continue the program. And before I get to my testifiers, just a little bit of data on some of the outcomes. There was a report done by the University of Minnesota on co-parent court, a problem-solving court to establish paternity, support families, strengthen communities. And what was happening is the courts were referring people to North Point to their parenting courses. And so some of the outcomes, for instance, with child support, amount of child support paid, and this is for data from 2013, there were two groups. There was a control group and an intervention group. The intervention group was the one that where the participants of the classes were. And intervention group, where moms completed the intervention program, the child support owed was 81.the percentage of child support paid was 81.8%, and where dads completed under the courses, it was 85.5%. And when both parents created the co-parenting course, the total number, the percentage of child support paid was 86.78%. And so those are really some good numbers. And I had the opportunity a few weeks ago to sit down and participate in one of the co-parenting courses. They do split it up. The moms meet in one evening or one time a week, and the dads meet another time. And so I sat in on the moms group and was just very impressed with the quality of the curriculum and the amount of interaction between the instructor, who was Rose, and the participants. Very open dialogue, and I feel like it's a very worthwhile program, and I think it'll go a long way to helping to strengthen those kids' lives when the parents are both involved. So I would turn it over to testifiers, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed in any order you like.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Sarah Levin. I work for North Point Health and Wellness Center. North Point Health and Wellness Center is located in North Minneapolis, and we're an integrated health and human services agency. We have a full-service clinic that offers medical, dental, and behavioral health, And we also have a human services side, which offers food support, chemical dependency treatment, and client family services, which is the area that I work in. Our approach is culturally responsive and trauma-informed care that really focuses on the person, the community well-being, and health quality. The program that is before you today for consideration is Co-Parent Court. This program first operated as a demonstration project from the years 2010 to 2012 in partnership with Hennepin County Family Court, community organizations, and the University of Minnesota. The goal was to create a model for paternity establishment that supported co-parenting that really focused on improving the social, emotional, and financial outcomes for children and families. The co-parent court meets the unique needs of unmarried parents through a combination of both parenting workshops and also individualized advocacy and support. The facilitated workshops are based on 4-week evidence-based curriculum, which is designed to focus on positive parenting and relationship building. The co-parent navigators work individually with parents to address barriers such as housing, employment, and health care. Finally, parents are assisting with completing a parenting plan, which guides them through joint decision-making about how they want to raise their children together. Representative Scott talked about a lot of the positive outcomes that we saw with the initial project. We saw an increase of the non-custodial parents paying into their child support. We also saw an increase in the amount of time that non-custodial parents spent with their child. And we also saw an increase in the perception, the positive perception about parents and the time spent with each other. And it's important to understand that this has not just been experienced in our model. It has actually been researched and proven that parenting time and the engagement in the payment of child support really go hand in hand. It's a very related thing. Addressing parenting time improves parent-child contact, and with that, what happens is both positive parental engagement and financial contributions by both parents increase. According to many researchers, advocates, and policymakers, future progress in child support collections will require making the system more responsive to unmarried caseload rather than just obtaining additional enforcement remedies. So we really do feel that while this is relationship-based, that this also has financial aspects that it supports. The other thing to understand is that in a study that was in a study by the Inspector General, 61% of parents paid more child support after services, very comparable to co-parent, where they really focus on parenting time and also the engagement between parents. This is a model that we know works. We know it will impact children, families, parents, and the community at a significant level. With your support, we can continue to document the model and evaluate the long-term financial and social impact so it can be replicated amongst other communities. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Hi, my name is Rose McCullough, and I work with North Point Health and Wellness. I am the instructor and the advocate for mothers in my program. And what we do in our program has been very successful. I've seen multiple families reunite, not asking them to be a couple, but to learn how to co-parent. And has been a very positive experience for a lot of the children. They have benefited from both sides of the families. And they both parents found the program to be very helpful to them to learn how to co-parent, to learn how to talk to one another, communicate with one another. The workshops that we do teach, we talk about a lot of different topics, from healthy relationships to communication to budgeting, how to finance, to be financially responsible. So this program has worked overall very well. We've had so many positive and success stories that I could write a book about. And it's just been a wonderful experience. A lot of fathers have felt like in the past they had no voice, they had no kind of say-so in their children's lives. But through this program, we have been able to bring fathers to the table and let them know that you do have a voice and you do have something to say in your rearing of your children or your child. So it's just a wonderful program. I've been with this program from the very beginning, since 2010 until present, and I hope that we can continue the services in North Minneapolis.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone from the public who would like to testify on this bill? All right. Seeing none. We will go to member questions. Members? Representative Locklear.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to say that I've heard from judges in Hennepin County and others about how much this has helped in their working with families, and they're just ecstatic about the outcomes, and many of the people served are not going through a court system at all, which is why it's before us. But it started, I think, out of some of those concerns that they were seeing, and really appreciate this. I think it's a model that needs to move forward and expand.
All right. Thank you. Other questions, discussion? Seeing none, final thoughts, Representative Scott.
I just would appreciate your support. I know you're hearing a lot of bills today, but one of the things that when I set out to run for the legislature that I wanted to do is help improve the lives of children and families, and I think this is a really great program that makes that happen for a lot of people.
Thank you, Representative Scott. We do appreciate it, and the advocates, thank you for coming today. Mm-hmm. With that, House File 1362 is laid over for possible inclusion in our Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Thank you.
Thank you,
next up, we have House File 2047. Representative Frankie moves. I will move House File 2047 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Welcome to the committee, Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members.
And Representative Frankie, I'm sure that the pages will pass out the treats for the introductory bill for our committee, as you did for the Policy Committee and Representative Schumacher's committee. So,
of course, Mr. Chair, they are on their way.
They're on their way.
Don't worry, I will not forget you.
All right.
It's all about responsibilities.
There we go. welcome to the committee, and I've moved House File 2047. Representative Frankie, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This is House File 2047. This is a direction and a very important subject that I think I'm going to try to be brief on, something that deserves a lot more discussion, but in the interest of time, we'll just speak to the bill. I'll allow my testifier to speak, and then we'll get to your questions. This bill directs the Commissioner of Health to work with the Commissioner of Human Services and other stakeholders to develop a statewide comprehensive plan of priorities and actions to address HIV and AIDS in Minnesota. It allows the Commissioner to develop a plan as a part of an existing department activities. It requires a plan to determine the levels of testing and care, services necessary to eliminate HIV, and it specifies initial outcomes that must be met. It provides for recommendations for how to use existing funds to make the greatest impact and to ensure coordinated statewide effort. It provides recommendations for new and enhanced interventions and additional resources needed for these interventions, and it is to be developed using existing resources. It directs the Commissioner to submit a comprehensive plan and the recommendations to go with it to the chairs and ranking minority members of the legislative committees with jurisdiction over HHS policy finance by February 1st, 2018. This bill is a great bill. It'll help us to decide where we need to better push our resources toward to come up with the best income or outcome. So with that, I am going to turn it over to Chuck Peterson, Executive Director of CLARE Housing, and he would like to say a few words.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Peterson. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Chuck Peterson. I serve as Executive Director of CLARE Housing. We're a 501c3 nonprofit organization that believes all people deserve a chance to live their best lives, and every individual has a place and a right to be cared for in society. I'm here today to support House File 2047, which requires Minnesota Department of Health to create a statewide comprehensive plan to end HIV/AIDS in Minnesota. A coalition of HIV providers, including CLARE Housing and the Minnesota AIDS Project, have been working on the creation of a plan for over 4 years, so I'm pleased to see that this bill is finally being considered today. I was in my teens when my brother returned home from serving in the Vietnam War. The night he arrived, he shared with my parents that he was gay. My father immediately kicked him out of the house, and he was told never to return. Homeless, a vet with no place to go, it was several years later that I received the phone call that my brother was diagnosed with AIDS. In the early days of the epidemic, our government was silent on HIV and LGBT issues. Stigma, fear, and a lack of appropriate care resulted in thousands of lives lost. Our aunts, our uncles, our sisters, our sons, our daughters, our mothers and our fathers, and including my brother. Today, there's nearly 9,000 people living with HIV in Minnesota. And over the last 10 years, we've seen on average over 300 new infections each year. In 2015, our most recent year of data from the Minnesota Department of Health, we found that HIV cases among 20 to 29-year-olds increased by 24%. The number of cases among interjection drug users increased by 86%. And 58% of all newly diagnosed people with HIV came from communities of color. Our ask is simple. We want to focus attention on the fact that we already have the tools to permit us to effectively eliminate HIV in Minnesota and to challenge ourselves as a community to collectively do it. Public health officials around the country support the premise that testing, prevention, and treatment is the key to finally pushing the number of new HIV infections downward and ending the epidemic as we know it today. We've reached a point in Minnesota where we can envision the possibility of zero new HIV infections, but it will take an incredible amount of coordination, innovation, and work to make this vision a reality. That's why we're asking the Department of Health to take a leadership role in developing a statewide plan that addresses 4 points that mirror the national HIV strategy. Reduce the number of new infections in Minnesota by 75%. Increase the number of people living with HIV who know their status to 90%. Increase the number of people living with HIV who are retained in care and receiving treatment to 90%. And increase the number of people who are HIV positive and virally suppressed to 90%. We know when an individual knows their HIV status, they have access to health care, they are receiving treatment, that they have a much higher success rate at becoming virally suppressed. And by lowering the amount of HIV virus in a person's body, it helps them stay healthy, live longer, and eliminates, totally eliminates, the chance of passing HIV on to others. This is our pathway to dramatically reducing new infections in Minnesota. But we can't do it alone. We need to take a serious look at what is working and what is not. We need to direct funding to where it will have the greatest impact over the next 5 to 10 years. We need a vision for Minnesota, and we need it now. It's time to end this epidemic, and your vote today is taking action to help stop new HIV infections and make the AIDS epidemic a relic of the past in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Is there anyone from the audience that would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, there are the appropriation from this bill is within existing appropriations, so there's no fiscal note, no cost. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was actually the piece I was going to ask about. And I'm very supportive, of course, of the goal of this, and I thank Representative Frankie for bringing it forward. I understand the department is doing things right now that would implement a plan or implement this section, and that should be recognized. But the section still does require a new plan to be developed using existing resources, and I guess I'm just wondering what the department would not do. I guess that troubles me. It feels like if we want the department to do something new and different, that they need the funds to do that, or we need to identify the things that they're not going to do in order to do this. And maybe it's a very small cost to develop a plan, maybe it's a couple thousand dollars, but in that case it should be pretty easy to allocate that. If it's a higher cost, then that means that there's more things that they're not doing in order to be able to do this. So I guess I just, and again, not at all the merits of this, I think it's wonderful work, but I do feel like if we're going to have something that is such an important goal, we should provide the resources to support that goal. And so I guess perhaps Representative Frank, I was like, has a comment on that.
Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pinto, we did work with the department on some language for an amendment. They asked for the amendment to be structured in such a way as not to take away from their federal funding. So the federal funding that they get depends upon the amount and how the direction of the state funding comes in. So they asked for it to be worded this way so that they can work within the existing parameters that they already have.
Yes, Mr. Chair, my understanding is that I think that's referring, but please, Representative Frankie, correct me if this is wrong, but I was referring to the sentence that says it's 1.12 to 1.14, I guess, the commissioner may implement the section utilizing existing efforts. Are you referring also to the next sentence that the department was actually saying they do not want resources to be provided to develop the plan? Are you referring to both sentences or? Because I guess I thought the amendment was that first sentence.
No, actually, Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, the amendment spoke to 1.2 through 1.4.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I guess then, and maybe if there's a representative from the department here, but just if they can estimate how much this plan would cost to develop. I just, as I say, hate to ask them to do something if we don't know how much it's going to cost them to do it.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name is Chris Ayersman. I'm the Director for Infectious Disease at the Minnesota Department of Health. And the reason that we indicated that we did not need resources for this is because we've already embarked on this process and have done so in collaboration with the Department of Human Services, and they provided us with resources to start this. So we have started working on a statewide plan for the last 6 or 7 months, and so that's why we didn't need to ask for additional resources, because we've received those resources from DHS and we're working in collaboration. Thank you.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, I guess no need for more resources.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think this is a great move forward, and I'm glad that it's before us. I note that the department is to develop a plan in consultation with community stakeholders, but there's no reference to the statewide HIV care and prevention task force, which is actually demographically balanced to reflect all the communities that you noted are at right now seeing the highest rates of infection, including people who are young, people who are people of color, people who have been IV drug users, as well as people in the service system. And I know there was a big competition to get selected for that, and I'm just wondering why there isn't a reference to that, since it is the group that has for years been advising on this topic. And I think it's nice to recognize the people who step up to serve on these advisory committees and make difficult decisions in terms of advising about use of federal funds, to not recognize them in this important legislation, I think is an oversight. And I wondered if you might consider adding them in addition to community stakeholders, as you referenced that, because they are an official state group.
I'm sure you will. Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I also you heard the bill in the policy committee, of course, and I'm completely happy about the bill and glad that this would be moving forward. But I'm just a little bit unsure, though, about, since no money is being provided, what is the bill doing that isn't being done already? I mean, why do we have a bill if the department is already doing this? It's more of a question for the department, I think, if the testifier could come back, because I just would like to understand a little bit from their point of view.
Welcome back to the committee, Ms. Ayersman.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So what is the bill doing that the department isn't doing already?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I think that the intent of the bill is to bring attention to this issue, because certainly the department has done work related to HIV prevention for many years, but by bringing this to the attention of the legislature, it really raises the issue, and it also makes you aware of the fact that we are doing planning, and that we will come up with a plan that may have information that would inform decision making that you make going forward related to how resources could be invested in this issue. So that's part of the value of doing this. But yes, we continue to do this work because it's our public health directive and mission, but there is a value in bringing this forward to this body because of the role that you play in prioritizing and making decisions.
Absolutely. Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. And I just say it has a report, so that's a good thing that, gives a deadline for everybody by which to kind of give us some information about what's going on. My other question is, so under this plan, the plan must reduce the number of new diagnoses by at least 75%. That would be great. Why not 100%?
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, yes, always our public health goal is to achieve you know, high levels of success. This goal actually is even higher than the national goal. So we want to have a goal that's aspirational, but that has some level of realism attached to it. And so, especially when we are bringing it to the legislature. So that's why our goal is ultimately 100%, but we thought we should have some aspect of realism. So.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be looking for 100%.
We will too.
Okay.
I think we all are.
All right. Other questions for the testifiers? Seeing none, we'll ask comments for Representative Franke.
I just want to thank the chair and the members for hearing this bill today. I thank you for your support.
All right, Representative Franke, and I'm actually going to move that House File 2047 be moved to the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. House File 2047 is re-referred to the general register. Thank you, Representative Franke. Next up, we have House File 202, Representative Grunhagen. Representative Grunhagen moves House File 202 be held over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. I see no amendments in the packet, and there is a fiscal note. Representative Grunhagen moves House File 202. Representative Grunhagen, to the bill.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This bill is a very simple thing. It removes the, from outside the seven-county metro area, the 10% requirement on dental providers. In terms of medical assistant patients, I have two dentists here who will testify succinctly and to the point as to why it actually reduces access rather than increases access.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Gentlemen, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, I am Dr. Michael Flynn from Lewiston, Minnesota. I'm a general dentist in the rural area. I'm the only dentist in Lewiston, and I think that is a reason we'll, or this bill, I support 202, and I'll refer to the law or the Rule 101. Rule 101, in my opinion, is ineffective. It does not work. It is actually a hindrance to access to care, which I think was its original intent. Now, let me outline why I feel that way. Occasionally when we're audited, it's a very difficult rule to audit. I don't think there has been many audits, but what we deal with in rural Minnesota is a participation like in my area is. I deal with all the people in that area. It doesn't matter what plan they're on. And what we're finding in rural Minnesota is we're losing our dentists. That is something you will have to deal with soon. And Rule 101 is a hindrance. The average age of a dentist in greater Minnesota is 58. So in the next 10 years, I'm going to suggest to you half of us might retire. And that includes me. I'm 64. And we're finding that for every three dentists that are retiring or moving on in life, currently we're only replacing them by one dentist. And that one dentist that's replacing us, Rule 101 is a complete hindrance to allowing them to come to Greater Minnesota along with other issues. So I support House File 202.
Thank you, Dr. Flint. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
I'm Al Olson from Caring Hands Dental Clinic in Alexandria, Minnesota. We're a nonprofit organization that provides 98% of our patron base is Medicaid, which also includes sliding fee scales, uninsured, and veterans. The Rule 101 has been a problem in rural Minnesota for a long time. And I agree with Dr. Flynn, it's pretty unenforceable, but yet it scares dentists from participating at all. Rather than take the chance of doing 9% and getting in trouble, they take the safe zone and do zero. That's where they're safe. And they make their living chairside, and they don't make a living doing mathematics on what patient they've seen throughout the year with what insurance. And so it has been a hindrance. Our More Smiles program has helped satisfy some of the dentists in our region that we work with because they piggyback on our clinic, which, of course, at 98%, we're covered for Rule 101, which they are too. But there's other dentists that I've worked with over my 11 years at the clinic that are scared of the 101. And so they, again, choose the point of being safe, do none. So it is a rule that certainly we support 100%. Talking to a lot of my doctors before I came down, they supported 100%. And I think you'll see an access issue created by eliminating it. And numbers are known, but if you only had 10 people go to the 10 patients to every one of the rural dentists, it'd be over 9,000 patients, just that small number. So it's a good thing to consider, and I hope you find that we're right.
All right. Thank you, doctors, for drilling down on that a little bit. They've given us a lot to chew on. All right, Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was on this last year. I didn't get on it this year.
You can sign up yet.
I'd like to. I've learned the same thing in the Mankato area, too. 101 was, I believe, had the best of intentions, but we are having people that are having to go 100, 120 miles for dental care, and so I think it's worth trying this, so I'm supporting the bill.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and first of all, Mr. Olson, we spoke in my office, and I asked you about this very thing, and what you told me was, it's not enforced, so it doesn't make any difference. And I remember that very clearly, so I don't know, I think you've got a different opinion today than you did when we were speaking privately. But anyway, my question, I guess, for Representative Grunhagen is, if it's good for rural, why isn't it not good for everybody?
Representative Grunhagen.
Well, I thought, thank you, Ms. Chair, Representative Leibley. With the amount of government employees in the metro area, I thought it would be, you know, sometimes we do things by steps, and I thought let's start with the rural area, because the rural area, there is a crisis in terms of access for Medicaid or medical assistance dental providers. And in my district, there's only one dentist in the entire area that accepts medical assistance. And my sister works for a dentist. And they get calls every day about access. And they simply turn him away because he turned out to be one of the dentists who got audited, didn't have 10%. Well, somebody reported him. He didn't have 10% of his patients' medical assistance. And now he takes none. So it's used... when it is used, I think like the testimony came from the dentist here, it's a scare tactic. So let's remove it. It was probably well-intentioned when it started, but the net effect in the rural area is less access. And if it's successful in the rural area, then we can take the additional step in the Seven County metro area. Providing that additional step.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the other thing, Representative Grunhagen, I thought you passed this a year or two ago. What happened?
Representative Grunhagen.
I think you were on the conference committee and you got rid of it. No, I'm just kidding. No, my memory's wrong on that, Representative Liebling. No, it got dropped in the conference committee between the House and the Senate. Things have changed now, so we'll see what happens this time.
Thank you. And I can just say, as a member from the Seven County metro area that represents a lot of dentists and MA patients, I can tell you that people in my district who are on MA do have choices within 20 miles. People in northwest Minnesota and much of greater Minnesota don't have the transportation or the ability to get out. We need more dentists. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just remind the members that if they have a specific issue with a testifier, instead of scolding them in front of everybody, that maybe they can take that offline? Thank you, Mr. Olson, for coming down here from Alexandria. Appreciate that.
All right. Further discussion. Representative Grunhagen.
To be clear, Mr. Olson is from Representative Branson's district.
Excellent.
Thank you for providing.
All right, further discussion? Seeing none, House File 202 is laid over for possible inclusion in our Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Gentlemen, thank you for making the trip to St. Paul today. We do appreciate it. Appreciate your good work for providing dental care in greater Minnesota. Next up, we have House File 1861. Okay. House File 1861 is offered by Representative Anselmo. Welcome to the committee, sir. I will move House File 1861 be held over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. We have the bill before us. Representative Pinto is going to be offering the 191 amendment that members will find in your packet. Representative Anselmo, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Dean and Committee. I'm here to introduce House File 1861, which deals with securing more funds for the Food Shelf Program as it's run by Hunger Solutions. We're looking for a $500,000 appropriation per year, and this really deals with the additional sort of food challenges for people that are food insecure. That's 1 out of 10 people, and trying to find a way to get more proteins, fruits, and vegetables to them, which today I'm not doing a very good example of that because I'm passing out some really bad food for you to snack on, so I apologize. I also like to note that the companion bill is in the Senate. It's been offered by our state senator, Edina, which is where I hail from. We have a number of food companies that are based out of there, and people there are very concerned about people and their food insecurity. I do have three testifiers, one to talk to the amendment and two to the bill.
All right. Before we pick up the amendment, Representative Considine had something?
No, I don't.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sure.
All right. Do you want to go ahead and put the amendment on first, Representative Anselmo, or how would you like to proceed?
Yes, can I offer the amendment, or do I need a member?
Representative Pinto will offer the 191 amendment. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am offering the 191 amendment. This is sort of essentially an author's amendment. The folks who you'll see the diapers for babies hand out in your packet, and these folks have spoken with me, and I think both the bill's author and I had put forth the exact same language, so I would ask folks to support it on his behalf, and you'll hear more about it as we go.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Representative Pinto moves the 191 amendment. All those in favor of adoption of the 191, please say aye.
Aye.
I suppose no. The 191 is adopted. Representative Anselmo, to your bill as amended.
All right, thank you. Now that's in good form, I'd like to introduce my first testifier and kind of go from there.
Great. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Colleen Moriarty, and I'm the Executive Director of Hunger Solutions Minnesota. We work on behalf of more than 300 food shelves in the state of Minnesota. We work with them so that they have the available resources to serve the more than 3 million visits that were made to those food shelves this year. There's been a 6% increase since 2011. So while other sectors have seen the economy improve, those who need help to make it through the day and through the month are still at the doors of food shelves, large and small, in the state of Minnesota. One of the things that has been particularly a struggle for the food shelves is to be able to provide fruits, vegetables, and proteins in an appropriate setting, to have the infrastructure to be able to do that, and also the availability of these products. These are things that our people who are living in challenged circumstances surely need. They need improved nutrition. And so this bill in particular is one where we're looking at improving the nutritional quality of the food that's going out through the emergency food system and availability to those more than 3 million visits. We've seen a particular increase of seniors visiting food shelves in the state of Minnesota, and they are additionally challenged living on fixed incomes to be able to provide those kinds of resources. So today we formed an important collaboration with the availability of an additional product to be distributed through the food shelves, and that is the diapers. And so we have other testifiers who are going to testify to that need. It's an honor to serve the people in the state of Minnesota who are greatly in need.
Thank you. The next testifier, please. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Peter Whitehawk, a community organizer with Hunger Solutions Minnesota, and appreciate the opportunity to testify today. Statewide, many of the food shelves now operate under a client choice model, which allows the clients to select the foods that they need and offers healthier options. many of these healthier options, the proteins, fruits, and vegetables are some of the most expensive items for food shelves to purchase, and many of the community food drives typically yield a lot of canned or boxed goods, food that most people empty out of their pantry. It's very rare to see something like a pound of ground beef, for example, donated at a food drive. And because of that, food shelves often have to purchase things like fresh meats and produce. This bill will provide funding specifically for these foods so they can buy them when they are needed and help meet the client's nutritional needs, which will lead to better individual and community health. House File 1861 would add $500,000 to the appropriations, specifically to buy proteins, fruits, and vegetables, so they can keep up with the demand for their services and get healthy foods in the hands of many hardworking, low-income Minnesotans. We encourage you to support this bill, and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. And we have Joe Rush from the Humphrey School. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Joe Rush, and I represent a group of leaders participating in the Policy Fellows Program at the University of Minnesota School of Public Affairs. Our cross-sector group of government, nonprofit, and business leaders, including representatives from Cargill, Target, and Best Buy, is working on a project to address the diaper need for low-income families in Minnesota. We are excited to support this first-of-its-kind United States legislation to this bill to directly address the diaper need among low-income families across the state of Minnesota. Here's some facts about that diaper need. In Minnesota, more than 1 in 3 low-income families report struggling to afford the $80 monthly cost per child of diapers. This is increased illness and infection in children whose parents have to reuse reusable diapers and keep the child in dirty diapers too long. Research conducted by the National Diaper Bank through the Yale University's Moms Partnership reported a strong correlation between diaper need and maternal depression. And there are no federal or state programs that directly address the cost of diapers. And many work support programs such as SNAP and WIC cannot be used to buy diapers. Lack of diapers affects children's ability to go to child care, where many providers require at least a 1 week supply of diapers, making it more difficult for parents to go to work. This $130,000 appropriation for diapers to food shelves will reach all 87 Minnesota counties and distribute up to 1 million diapers per year. I urge you all to support this efficient and effective approach to addressing the diaper need because it uses the purchasing power of bulk buying and reaches low-income families where they're already returning for help. Through this appropriation, Minnesota can again be a leader in supporting healthy and financially stable children and families, the foundation of our state's success. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rush, for your testimony. Is there anyone else from the audience who'd like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member questions. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to note, I was at a food shelf in my community just, well, not that long ago. I'm trying to think of exactly when. But it was really apparent the lack of proteins and fruits and vegetables. And even the canned goods, folks are not able to go there that often. So this is just, and then certainly diapers as well. We're talking about people in really desperate circumstances. This is a really basic need. So I want to thank the bill's author and thank the testifiers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify one thing, are we talking disposable diapers or cloth diapers?
Mr. Rush.
Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, those would be disposable diapers.
Okay. Thank you to the author for bringing this bill forward. My wife sits on the board of our local food shelf, and my father started it, so you're dear to me. Thank you.
All right. Seeing no further questions. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Anselmo. Final thoughts.
Final thoughts. I'd like to thank the chair and committee for hearing this bill and appreciate your support. Also, I'd like to add that the additional treats that are being brought here are not all mine. So the peanut, the protein was for me. The cake is not from the representative from Edina. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Anselmo, with that. House File 1861 is laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you. All right. Next up, we have 1182, Representative Peterson. Representative Peterson, I will move House File 1182 be held over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. I see no amendments, and there is a fiscal note in packets. Representative Peterson, I will move 1182 to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you do want more treats, I do have cookies. I'm just, being generous, but I'll have to get somebody over here to pass them out. Currently, families whose incomes are too high to qualify for medical assistance can still receive some in-home supports for their children with disabilities through medical assistance programs, technically called TEPRA, and waived services. So families using these services pay fees for the middle, and basically their fees that are paid on a sliding fee scale, and they can be hundreds of dollars to middle-class families. So these fees greatly increased about a decade ago to the point of unaffordability for many Minnesota families. And that has resulted in depleting their savings and retirement funds, and have been forced to sometimes declare bankruptcy. Some families have decided to not receive TEPRA or waived services because the parental fee was simply too high, thus denying their children the parental services that they need. And some of these services include physical therapy, behavioral therapy, speech therapy, and personal care services. House File 1182 will cut parental fees in half so they are more affordable and families with children with disabilities can receive the MI supports that they need. And, Mr. Chair, I do have a few testifiers here today. Anybody in yellow?
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please proceed with your testimony in whatever order you would like.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Lisa, and I am the mom of four amazing kids. Cooper, sitting next to me, is the youngest. He was born with a syndrome, which is pretty rare, called Crigler-Shaw syndrome. He's missing part of his fifth chromosome. He had a feeding tube for the first 7 years of his life and has attended physical, occupational, and speech therapy since birth. He was able to obtain MA through TEPRA when he was 5 years old. It allowed us to get a PCA so that I could care for all four of my kids. The alternative therapies that were not typically covered under health insurance, including music therapy, water swimming, hippotherapy, were critical for creating independence and function for Cooper. And yet the parental fees for MA have been staggering and overwhelming for my family. We felt stuck because really the only way to access these services was to be on MA. So for Cooper's health, we chose to keep paying the fees. 6 years ago, after a divorce, I needed to return to the workforce. Unfortunately, it was very difficult to find a job that would allow time off for Cooper's frequent illnesses and the number of days he had off from school. And on the flip side, it was nearly impossible to find a personal care attendant willing to work such random hours. I created my own business so that I would have the flexibility to take care of Cooper's needs, but that meant I needed to get my own health insurance. Currently, I pay over $12,000 a year for my personal insurance. Cooper's father pays for his. I also pay $4,000 a year for TEPRA fees, and his father pays $8,000 a year. It is a constant challenge for me to balance the hours I work so that I can come up with the money to cover the fees for Cooper. Many times I have considered quitting work completely so that I simply don't have to pay the fees or worry about balancing the amount I make to the amount of fee I owe to the amount of bills that need to be paid. I am exhausted, and the stress of caring for a child with unique challenges along with the financial responsibilities has resulted in multiple chronic health conditions for me. Cooper is an amazing young man with incredible potential for the future. He changes lives every day with his smile and perseverance. And as his mom, I am committed to raising him in our home and our community because it is the best place for him to be. But it comes with a price that I think is too high for my budget and for my health. At 15, Cooper requires 24-hour supervision. He needs help dressing, eating, communicating, learning, and relating to others. In the morning, I get up at 4 so that I know that he's safely in bed when I get ready. I get him on the bus at 7:20, clean up the house quickly so that I can get to work and be back in time to get him off the bus at 2:30. Every afternoon, I bring him to either a therapy or recreational activity to keep him engaged in the community. When I get home, I try to find something to keep him occupied so that I can prepare dinner. If I'm not careful, he leaves the house and has been known to start the neighbor's cars. Because of his communication struggles, he can become frustrated and will hurt himself. He bites his hand till it bleeds or bangs his head. As he becomes bigger, it's becoming more difficult for me to physically help him to be safe. I use the Caddy CDS scooter with Tucker Fuse mostly for personal care assistance help. If you can imagine, now, especially as a teenager, Cooper gets frustrated with Mom as 24/7 caregiver. He thrives when a first person with fresh energy arrives to work with him. I also use it to provide technology that allows him to be part of the community and the general ed setting. Therapies that are constantly helping to increase his independence and decrease his self-harm, and adaptive equipment that creates a way for him to live a meaningful life. In fact, 2 years ago, because of these services, I was able to get him removed from a contained classroom that he had been in since birth to including him in the general education classroom 100% of his day with his typical peers in the community. Having MA has been a lifeline for me, for Cooper, and for his siblings. However, the fees are slowly choking the life out of me as I struggle to work, to juggle work, his care, my health, our home, budget, etc. Please consider supporting the bill that will reduce the fees for parents to pay to provide necessary care to our most vulnerable constituents. It matters because they matter. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, my name is Christine Erickson. I live in White Bear Township. This is my son, Bentley Erickson. We moved here almost 1 year ago. Bentley was born at 31 weeks, weighed 2 pounds, 10 ounces. I would just like you to think about your own family and what would you do for your child. I pretty much can assure you that each one of you would do anything that it takes for your child. Bentley's care averages $1 million per year. There was not a disabled line to get in at the hospital. I went to the hospital like most every other mother, expecting to bring home a baby, go back to work in 6 weeks, and carry on with my life. We spent 4 months in the hospital. In the first 12 months, we spent 10 more times in the hospital. Bentley will be 6 in June and has had 12 major surgeries. I quit counting how many hospitalizations because I still can't take it anymore. I choose to pay for private insurance. I choose to go to work. I choose to contribute to society because I think that as a mom is what I'm supposed to do. My private insurance is paying and saving Medicaid approximately $15,000 per month for Bentley skilled nursing care just so I can work. I only have hours so my husband and I can work. I cannot get a second job. There is nobody to help take care of him. My husband and I are the only ones that know how to take care of him and the nurse, who is only there while we work. We arrived here and were abruptly told that we had to pay $800 on about June 25th and said I had until June 30th of this last year to pay it, and that we were going to be have another $3,800 due by this year. And I called my friend Joe at the parental fee division. Joe told me that my son was a burden on society, I quote, and wanted to know if this was a one-time instance or this was going to go on. And I explained it's going to go on as long as Bentley lives and God allows them to live. I asked Joe where this money is supposed to come from. Joe told me to stop paying my other bills. Stop paying my other bills. I can't be homeless. Bentley requires 24-hour care. When I became upset and explained that we didn't get in the disabled line, we got what God gave us. Joe told me, asked me if I would like him to call my husband to explain it to him better.
What?
Yes, that is exactly what Joe said, and if Joe is in this room, I'd love to shake his hand and possibly kick him in the shins. I do not need anybody to explain anything to my husband. I would like to explain something to Joe. Caring for my disabled child or any other disabled child, good is not good enough. My child has just as much worth as everybody else's child. Bentley's life matters just like your life matters and your life matters. I cannot afford to pay this money unless I can spoon out a kidney today for you. I've written 25, 30 letters to Ellen DeGeneres. I have signed up for grants. Since we moved here, beginning May 1st of this year, we've gone to 92 appointments. 92 appointments you have to take off of work. I don't get to go to the therapy appointments because I can't. I can't make it happen. I can't afford it. Can't even afford the cupcakes you're passing around. 92 appointments. Please tell me how I can pay this. I would love to know. There are no walks for Golden Horse Syndrome. There is no cure for Golden Horse Syndrome. There's nobody to save us. There's honestly nobody that really cares. The people that say, call me if you need anything, are never there. There isn't anybody. There is nothing. I can't afford this. Nobody can afford this. Please, I'm begging you. Please, please, save our families. I brought this here so you can remember Bentley.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson. And Ms. Larson tells me that that I had received an email from you, yes. And I asked if I could share that with everyone else on the yes. committee. It's not very often you get an email like that. And it did include some private information, so I'm glad you were I'm able to share that with the rest of the folks on the committee.
Thank you.
Representative Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Erickson.
Yes, sir. There you are. Yes, sir.
just want to say thank you.
Thank you, sir.
For coming here and talking to us about your son. And I may have missed something, but who the heck is Joe?
Joe is my contact who assures me he's never going away and I get to contact him. He is the A through F person in the parental fee division at DHS. Joe K. If you would like to find Joe, I'd like to find Joe too because I have something to say to him.
Representative Ross.
Mr. Chair, I'm gonna
find Joe.
I'd love to find Joe.
I'm going
to
bite my tongue and not.
This is the first time for everything.
My husband would even love to explain to Joe how upset he is, too, as well as my family, who has assured me that if I find Joe today, they'd be happy to bail me out.
Well, Mr. X, I just want to say, and I think everyone at this table would agree with me and tell you that the message that's been conveyed by some staff members within the department, no Minnesotan, no mother ever deserves to be treated in such a manner and talked to in such a manner. Those state employees are there to serve you.
Sir, I would love to thank you for that, but they don't. My phone calls go unanswered. I can't get any answers from anybody. I call and I call and I call. I've been here for a year. I'm a college-educated person. I've been an RN for 18 years. I'm not stupid, but my God, it is so hard to get through the system and coordinate care. I can't do it. And I'm persuasive. I'll kick in any door I need to kick in for Bentley, but...
Ms. Erickson, I assure you that, and the sad thing is, and I think we see this once in a while here at the Capitol, is that one activist or one parent raises a concern, and we can, as a committee, we can very directly let folks with the department know that this shall not happen again.
Thank you.
And that you need to be treated better. My challenge is that there's other people in the same range of the alphabet as you.
Yes.
That aren't being treated right.
Yes, sir.
And that's a concern. And so I guess not to drag this out, Mr. Chair, but when the testifiers are done, I'm wondering if there's someone from the department that would have a few moments to come down and answer some questions.
Yes, Representative Zerwath, and Ms. Erickson is going to be following up with her representative on this issue. So
thank you.
That would be me. So. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm spending another committee in this room where I can't keep my makeup intact. You mom warriors are really... inspirational. I'm sorry you guys have to fight so hard.
I know that there's nothing moms don't do for their kids, right? And there's nothing we won't do. And I appreciate, I want to echo those words that your kids' lives really matter, right? And you're working hard to make sure your families can stay together. And so we're with you. And thanks to Representative Peterson for carrying this. We are South Metro strong on this issue. We've got mom warriors in the South Metro who do an amazing job telling these stories as well. And so, you know, I think that I want to convey that we really do care and we really do have your back. I also want to remind people that we are budgeting for the next 2 years in the state of Minnesota. And that these priorities absolutely have to be part of the discussion when we talk about tax cuts, when we talk about transportation funding, when we talk about education funding. I feel like HHS has kind of served as an also-ran for far too long, and we've had families waiting for far too long, and it's time for us to keep our promises. So we'll keep all of your children in our hearts and thoughts and prayers, and we'll keep fighting for a target where we don't have to cut in HHS.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank you as well. Thank the testifiers as well. I'm a co-author on the bill and really appreciate Representative Peterson bringing it forward. There's a sentence in the bill, and what Representative Halverson just referenced. There's a sentence in the article that was handed out that just jumped out at me. The fees have increased over the years to help balance the state budget. And so I guess I want to make sure we're clear that that Joe Kay, that whatever happens with Joe Kay, and you need to be treated well by as all families do, by state employees and by all of us, and lifting up one another, to recognize that what's been going on with this program is pushing off financial costs on families. And this is a time where we're making decisions. And so if there is a target that our committee gets that involves a cut in some way, or involves just staying steady, that means that the funding for this would come out of some other funding there. And that's a choice that gets made as far as how those targets get set versus, for example, what are we going to do for people who are... are we emphasizing certain kinds of tax cuts? Are we going to be emphasizing supporting families in this way, and how do we balance that out? So I want to thank the families who are here and just recognize those are the sorts of choices that we're making and have made in previous years and need to make this time too. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you to Ms. Juilliard and also to Ms. Erickson for your testimony. There are other folks from the audience that would like to testify. Seeing none, Ms. Erickson, I'm told the department would like to talk to you to get the ball rolling before you leave today, so you might want to just right after you get done, just poke outside the door, and they'll probably catch you in the hall.
Yes, sir.
And we'll let them know this is not Joe Kay.
Thank you.
Representative Peterson, final thoughts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As you can see, this is an important issue, and just appreciate your support.
Thank you. With that, House File 1182, is this amended?
No.
Not amended. 1182 is held over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Peterson, and to your testifiers. All right. Next up, we have House File 1703. Representative Barr, I will move House File 1703 be held over for possible inclusion in our Health and Urban Services Omnibus Bill. Representative Barr... I see no amendments or fiscal note. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, in keeping with freshman tradition, I did bring treats. I'm not sure if they've gone out yet, but I see you've had some, but I will let your page distribute those if you'd like them. So,
thank you,
Mr. Chair and representatives for hearing my bill. I'd also like to recognize the other co-authors here, Representative Schumacher, Representative Fisher and Pinto. Really pleased to bring this bill forward. This bill proposes to increase access to evidence-based nurse home visiting programs here in Minnesota, including the Nurse Family Partnership Program. And the Nurse Family Partnership Program is an evidence-based community health program targeted to serve first-time, low-income moms and their babies. The Nurse Family Partnership clients are partnered with a registered nurse.
early in pregnancy and continue weekly and biweekly home visits until the child turns 2. Nurse Family Partnership clients receive the personalized care and support they need to have a healthy pregnancy, provide responsive and competent care for their children, and become more economically self-sufficient. Positive outcomes are shown in the areas of healthy pregnancy, responsive, competent care parenting, and economic self-sufficiency. There are also positive outcomes shown in areas of child development, school readiness, and reductions are shown in child maltreatment, abuse, childhood injuries, emergency department visits, juvenile delinquency, family violence, and crime. And that's one of the things I like about this program. It starts, a positive cycle for not only the mom and her child, but long-term for the family. The bill increases the Medicaid fee for service rate for evidence-based home nurse programs so that the rate more accurately reflects the cost of providing these services. And through that action, aims to increase access to these early intervention, long-term cost-saving services. So, Mr. Chair, I have a presenter, and if you'd like, we can hold questions until after the presenter, or the testifier, excuse me.
Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record, and we look forward to hearing your testimony.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Jenna Zunhager with the Nurse Family Partnership. Nurse Family Partnership, or NFP, is a voluntary, evidence-based health program that serves low-income women with their first child. Each new mom is partnered with a registered nurse early in her pregnancy and receives ongoing nurse home visits until that child turns 2 years old. Our nurse home visitors work with our families in order to achieve the proven outcomes of the NFP model, which are improvement in pregnancy outcomes, improvement in child health and development, and improvement in parents' economic self-sufficiency. As an evidence-based program, NFP is data and outcome-driven. Our data tracking and ongoing evaluation are built into our program funding and directly inform continuous quality improvement efforts. This data allows us to show the lifelong impact that NFP has on our moms, babies, and families, as well as the long-term reliance on government programs. Independent analysis by the Brookings Institute, RAND Corporation, and the Washington State Institute for Public Policy have all documented that NFP produces a positive return on investment for both government and society. A model developed by Dr. Ted R. Miller of the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation estimates that the cumulative cost savings to Medicaid will be approximately $180 per visit by the time the child turns 23 months in Minnesota, with additional cost savings accruing to Medicaid until that child turns 18. Overall, taking into account both government savings and other societal costs, NFP has a return on investment of $5.70 for every dollar invested in Minnesota. Further specific information on our outcomes and our return on investments can be found on the back of the handout that you have. Currently, Minnesota health plans reimburse for these services at levels somewhere between the current FFS rate of $63 per visit up to $200 per visit. Yet these rates really only reimburse a fraction of the average cost of the visit of $381. So we understand that you will all be faced with difficult decisions this session around funding priorities, but I would ask that you strongly consider that both the positive outcomes for the families that we serve and the cost savings for the state attributed to these evidence-based models far exceed the cost of the visits. Increasing the MA rate will support the sustainability of these cost-saving programs that impact the lives of Minnesota families. Thank you for your consideration, and I'd ask for your support.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Barr, do you have any other testifiers?
Not at this time, thank you.
Is there anyone from the audience who would like to testify or comment to this bill? Seeing none, questions for the testifier or the author of the bill from the committee members? Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to comment briefly. This is not just nice to have services. I have a constituent who I heard from regarding nurse home visiting whose baby's life was saved because of a nurse home visit. She was unknowingly struggling with the amount of milk she was producing. Her baby was malnourished, and she didn't know it. And the nurse walked in the house recognized it immediately, looked calmly at her husband and said, go to the store right now and get formula, and talk to that mother through the process. She saved a baby's life in my district. And so it sounds really nice to have a nurse in your home, but it's clearly a life-saving situation as well. And so thanks to Representative Barr for bringing this forward.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I support family home visiting, but I get a little concerned when we're dealing with a bill that's only for evidence-based practices, because at least in the past, I know that some of the family nurse partnership models would only serve and to replicate the evidence of that research was that a mother had to step up before delivery, I think in the first trimester, and that and otherwise they were not to be served. And, you know, we know that our most high-risk families often start with an unintended pregnancy, oftentimes a teen mom who isn't even maybe ready to acknowledge that she's pregnant at that point, let alone step up to being making a commitment to be involved in a program with others, adults. And so tell me, has that expanded, or is this still really limited to people who are willing to get engaged early? And because I do think we need to reach out to all new moms, particularly those who are high risk.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Nurse Family Partnership does only serve first-time moms, but there are other evidence-based models in Minnesota that do serve moms after the baby's born or after that 28 weeks that NFP requires, and they serve second-time moms, too. So Nurse Family Partnership does support the continuum of care that we see in Minnesota. We are fortunate that we have a variety of programs. We hope that this bill will provide an incentive for communities that don't have an evidence-based program to start one.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just hope when we allocate dollars, we'll look at the full continuum, because I think that's what's – the others may have different evidence and ratios of success, and I think we need a variety of approaches to react to the variety of families that we have.
Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Representative Barr. I think this is, you know, family home visiting is terrific. And I just really wanted to ask about or point out there's another bill moving also to fund the sort of the other kind of family home visiting through the public health departments, because this is great, but it doesn't cover the entire state. And as I've asked about this, and I don't think we had it. There was a reference to something in our packets, and maybe I just missed it, but I don't think we got a handout. But anyway, or at least I don't have one. But I know I saw a map before of what's covered, and there are chunks of the state that are not covered. And I just really want to, you know, for members to understand that this is a particular, these are particular programs. It's not... I think the term evidence-based, well, we know what that means in a certain context. I think here it's being used to label certain programs in addition to just the general meaning of evidence-based. And not to say anything bad about those programs, and I know they're great programs, but I think Representative Loeffler is referring to this too. It's not covering the entire field of either geographically or probably in terms of clients. It's just... you know, I asked why and was told that you have to have a critical mass of people to be able to have an evidence-based one of these programs in an area, and that might be why certain parts of the state are not covered. So I just really wanted to, members to be clear about, you know, which part of the field this is covering and which part it's not covering. So I know you talked about that a bit, but could you just kind of lay that out a bit more clearly for us? I think there's another bill coming forward that's also asking for increases for programs that are not covered by this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, that's a great question. I think right now we can reasonably say that about half of Minnesota counties are covered by an evidence-based program. There are several in addition to Nurse Family Partnership, and we do support that continuum of care. Another item that might be missing from your packet, we did include a support letter from Supporting Hands Nurse Family Partnership, which is unique in that it's a 20-county collaborative in southeast Minnesota. So we're continuing to work with MDH and other folks to bring those kind of collaboratives to those rural counties to make it more cost-effective to deliver an evidence-based program. But Nurse Family Partnership does support that broader ask of including the MA increase for all public health nurses.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a good bill. I like the fact that it starts early on. We have an achievement gap here in Minnesota. I think this is a great first step in helping to ensure the health and well-being of mothers and their children. It also helps to ensure the child's readiness for preschool and school, as well as helping to shore up the economic status of the family. And to me, that's a win-win. So thank you for hearing my bill today, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. House File 1703 is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Thank you for the testifier. Next up, we have House File 1357, Representative Grunhagen. There is a fiscal note and no amendments in the packet. Representative Grunhagen moves House File 1357 be laid over for possible inclusion in our Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Representative Grunhagen, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1357 expands the health care services that are covered when performed by a chiropractor. The bill would cover therapy services and evaluation and management services if the services are currently covered under medical assistance and by most private insurance companies. And they are within the chiropractic scope, or chiropractic scope of practice and are medically necessary. This is a May bill. It's not a shell. It simply puts the Chiropractic Association in a position where they can negotiate this with the Commissioner of Human Services and the Health Services Advisory Committee. Today I have with me Dr. Chuck Sawyer from the Minnesota Chiropractic Association, who would like to testify on the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I delivered testimony a week ago or so in the Health and Human Services Reform Committee, and some of you may have heard that. And one of the things I emphasized was the evaluation and management services, specifically examinations, and called attention to the fact that reimbursement is currently limited to one annual exam a year. So a typical scenario one can assume is, particularly for back pain, where it commonly recurs even within a one-year period. A patient might see me today, and that one annual exam is submitted for reimbursement, and that patient may either see me or another provider within a six-month period of time, give or take, and technically that second exam would not be covered. In addition to that, if the course of care requires some measure of treatment over a period of time, and a reexamination is both clinically indicated and actually required by DHS to substantiate the need for ongoing care, then that second examination would also not be covered. I've been just spending the last 10 minutes or so reading over the fiscal note, and while I can't comment on the numbers specifically in that document, I am looking at page 2 under the assumptions, and should note that it paints an incomplete picture. When the comparison is between chiropractic care or care provided by a chiropractic doctor and care provided by a physical therapist. So let me just highlight at least two elements that I think are missing from that analysis. DHS, in a fiscal note, indicates that the average per member per month cost for chiropractic care in 2016 was $70. That certainly makes sense because of the limited reimbursement and the limited array of services. And they also use the benchmark of $200 per member per month when the care was provided by a physical therapist. One thing I should note about that I hope you would understand is that in the overwhelming majority of instances, chiropractic doctors are practicing independently in small either solo practices or small group practices, and rarely within health systems. And the opposite is true with physical therapists, that the majority of which are practicing within health systems. Second of all, In the majority of instances, patients seeking care from chiropractic doctors for back pain will get the vast majority of that care in a chiropractic doctor's office. In other words, they're seeing a primary care physician who is really a conservative spine care specialist. The examination, the diagnosis, the course of treatment, and the follow-up will overwhelmingly, in most instances, happen within that chiropractic doctor's office. As opposed to the patient that would, for example, enter a large health system, Fairview or Allina or Essentia, and probably most notably Mayo, would likely first start with a primary care physician or an orthopedic specialist, and then go on to physical therapy. So if you track that cost on an encounter basis through either the chiropractic portal of entry route, as opposed to the route that a patient may go through seeing a medical physician first, the costs are inherently higher in the latter instance. Now, finally, this bill does not seek payment parity. So even if the services were provided by the chiropractic doctor, they would not be equivalent, given the nature of this bill, to care provided by a physical therapist.
All right. Is there anyone else from the audience who'd like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member questions? All right. Seeing none, final thoughts, Representative.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members, for hearing this. Again, I've sold health insurance since 1978. I've become a firm believer in chiropractic care and its ability to give patients cures and relief versus surgery or more expensive care. And again, this is a may. It's not a shall bill. It simply puts me in a position to negotiate with the Commissioner of Human Services.
Thank you, Representative Grinhagen. House File 1357 is held over for possible inclusion. Next up, we have House File 1649, Representative Haley. Representative Haley, you will move House File 1649 be held over for possible inclusion in Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. The bill is before us. Representative Haley, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Dean, and I did bring some treats and to recognize the heavy lifting that we have to do. They are monster cookies. We can leave them for later this evening if we like.
We will need them. Representative Halverson.
I think that we need to be careful how many freshmen get scheduled in one day. I'm very concerned about our health and the Health and Human Services Committee.
Mr. Chair, we will need the energy. We have 21 bills on the calendar. We are coming back tonight, and I didn't eat anything yet today. So, all right.
Thank you, Chair and members. I'd like to introduce you to House File 1649. This bill was brought to me by the Minnesota Home Care Association. And as we consider so many needs across the state, and we also are looking for savings, and this bill addresses potentially fraud in one area of health care. Let me give you some background. Last year, Congress passed the 21st Century Cures Act that included a provision that required states to implement an electronic visit verification system, first for personal care services by January 1st of 2019, and then also for home health care services by January 1st of 2023. This bill would set the framework for Minnesota to be compliant with this federal mandate by the deadlines and avoid any possible loss of our federal funds. The bill requires the Commissioner of Human Services to establish the implementation requirements to comply by doing three things. First, we need to engage all impacted stakeholders. And second, we need to establish baseline fraud prevention measures. And then also, lastly, issue a report to the legislature. This bill appropriates a small amount of funds for the development and implementation of the electronic service delivery system as required by federal law. I have with me today Kathy Messerly with the Minnesota Home Care Association, and she will take you through the technical components of the bill.
Mr. Chair,
please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Kathy Messerly. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Home Care Association. Before beginning my testimony, I'd like to thank Representative Haley for bringing this needed legislation forward. The system that is mandated by the federal law requires electronic verification of the following components: type of service, the service recipient, the date of the service, the location of the service, the individual who's providing the service, and lastly, the time the service begins and ends. This is an effort to address fraud, waste, and abuse in the personal care assistance programs and the home health care programs on the federal level. And it is consistent with the recent legislative auditor report. that talked about the home and community-based services. The Minnesota Home Care Association supports this bill and its enactment this year because we are convinced that for an electronic verification system to be effective and also be minimally burdensome to service recipients and providers, it needs thorough stakeholder engagement and buy-in. Also, the development and implementation of a new system that interfaces with the state, providers, direct care workers, and service recipients must be done in a way that allows for problems to be identified and corrected prior to a full rollout. I encourage you to support House File 1649, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Is there anyone from the audience who'd like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member questions. Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Haley. I would like to hear from DHS on this, if possible.
Anyone from DHS who'd like to address this? Welcome to the committee, Ms. White. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Stacey Twight with the Department of Human Services.
Yeah, thank you very much for coming down. I just wanted to know, this is going to be a big issue, and we had the legislative auditor's report. We're spending billions of dollars on home and community-based services, and what is recommended in that report is that we get some better financial reporting, and I know that the governor's budget had some recommendations around that. And I just wanted to hear from you if you're involved with this particular bill and if this is the direction that the department feels that we need to go. I mean, obviously, this is only one piece of where we need to go, but I just wanted to get some the department's point of view on it.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, thank you for the question. Yes, we've been working closely with the Home Care Association since the passage of the 21st Century Cures Act at the federal level, I believe back in December, and certainly this is tying in with what we're seeing additionally from the OLA's report, which is broader and talks about our home and community-based waiver services. The Cures Act legislation is specific to our home care program, so that's personal care assistance, the PCA, home health as well, but certainly we're interested in finding new ways to make sure our services are delivered appropriately in Minnesota.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
All right. Other questions? Seeing none, final thoughts, Representative Haley.
Whoa. All
right. With that, I'd ask for your support.
Thank you. With that, House File 1649 is held over for possible inclusion in our Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Thank you, Representative Haley. Representative Kreisha is up next with House File 815. I will move House File 815 be held over for possible inclusion in our Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. We do have a fiscal note and packet, no amendments. Representative Kreisha to House File 815.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I do have one testifier with me, and I'll let her speak to the program.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Hi. Thank you, Chairman Dean and members of the committee. My name is Deborah Bohm. I'm an adult nurse practitioner practicing in the state of Minnesota, and I'm here as a testifier today for House File 815, a bill to promote a study on retention and burnout for advanced practice providers, primary care clinicians in the state of Minnesota. Retention and recruitment of the primary care workforce is a big challenge, particularly in rural Minnesota. We're requesting an appropriation to study burnout and intention to leave primary care among advanced practice nurses in Minnesota. And the impact of this study would provide data and an opportunity for employers and the nurses themselves to mitigate workforce stress. When I testified last week in the Reform Committee, I talked about a personal story of work burden and described that not only in my practice but fairly universally in primary care, for every hour of direct service, there's at least 1 hour of background work, and how that affected my own personal life and health. We also had some conversation in that committee meeting about the burden of the electronic medical record and how that has expanded the complexity of delivering primary care. So we talked about this as an important problem with the study having specific aims to address the problem itself and to arrive at some actionable outcomes and solutions. So today, what I thought I would think about addressing with you is, why is this economically or fiscally prudent to do? And I went back to the 2016 final legislative report that many of you were on that committee on strengthening the Minnesota healthcare workforce that was published in December of 2016. And I looked at the executive summary of that report. And the first recommendation is to address identified workforce needs. The legislature should also address workforce healthcare supply and demand, rural issues, diversity, and workforce data analysis. The first charge in the 2016 legislative recommendation was to identify current and anticipated health care workforce shortages by provider types and geography, and to use the Minnesota Department of Health, which the study would filter through, to find integrative workforce informatics solutions and analysis. So I think the legislative committee itself is concerned about workforce in Minnesota, particularly in rural Minnesota. I looked at the economics of doing this study, and if we were to retain in practice even a small supply, probably less than 10 nurse practitioners, over the course, it would cover the course, the cost of this study, rather than the expense of re-educating and restarting a new 10 new nurse practitioners in counties. So what we want to find are specific actionable solutions that we can use to retain this very precious nurse workforce in the state of Minnesota delivering primary care.
All right. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify in this bill? Seeing none, member questions? All right. Seeing none. Final thoughts, Representative Crescia.
I would just ask for your support and inclusion to your possible bill.
Thank you. With that, House File 815 is held over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Next up, we have House File 2140. I will move House File 2140 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services omnibus bill. There is a fiscal note in the packet. No amendments. House File 2140, Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And with me tonight, or today, excuse me, and I do have some handouts at the page. I have to my right Dr. Kurt Devine, and to my left Dr. Heather Bell. And what this bill does, even though in one of the packets it's going to say it establishes an opioid task force, it actually doesn't establish it. It carries one forward. It's one that through the hard work of these two doctors and community members, they've set up what's working, what's actually effective. And I'd like them to tell you briefly why it's working. And what we're hoping we can do is continue to get this funded so that we can then also take this and replicate it in other communities. The reason I'm pushing for this one so hard is because of all the things that I have seen we're doing with opioids. This is something tangible. This is something we can wrap our hands around and say, here's a starting point. We actually have people, a process, and we have something that we can build success off rather than going back and trying to reinvent something. So with that, I'll turn it over to the individuals who've actually done the great work.
Welcome to the committee. Dr. Devine, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Hi, my name is Dr. Devine. I'm a family physician in Little Falls, Minnesota. Thank everybody for listening today about our little story. It's going to be fairly short and quick. There's a lot that you can talk about, and I think that there's nobody in this room that I have to tell there's an opioid crisis. I think we all understand that. I think that there's a lot of things I could talk about, including what the problem is and how it started and how difficult it's been and how shortage of treatment is and the difficulties getting some medications like Narcan. But the reality is that that doesn't solve the problem, and what we're about is the solution to the problem. And the problem really is the pills. And I think that, that often we lose that in the whole story of this opioid crisis. What our group really did was focused on that. And really, if you look at what we should be doing, we should be trying to put Narcan producers out of business, and we should be trying to put people who do drug treatment out of business. And the only way that we're going to do that is by dropping the number of pills that are coming out of our communities. And when we looked at doing our program, that's really where we started, was get the pills down, stop the pills from coming out of our clinic. And I think that you might look at that as being placing the bar quite high, but the reality is, if we put the bar low, that's exactly where we'll end up. And I think that we need to put that bar high, assuming that we can do this. So we're about the solution. We're not about what the problem is. We're about stopping the pills. If we look at who becomes heroin addicts, who becomes addicted to heroin, it all starts with pills. And I can tell you our experience in our clinic with the heroin addicts in Morrison County has been they started on pills. It's pills that are left over in their parents' homes because they were overprescribed when they had surgery. It's pills from the dentist, the orthopedist, and from family practice doctors. And it's the pills that end up in our schools, and it's the pills that end up at the crime scenes where people die. And that's really what this is about, is death. So what we want to do is we want to take our program, which we have done in our clinic, which is based on what we call a model using not just a doctor, but a model using a social worker, using a nurse, finding ways to track these patients that are in our clinics and to closely watch the narcotic use and the prescribing practice of our physicians. It's a way for us to manage people, to get them on the lowest possible doses. It's a way for us to make sure that there's not diversion of medications. It's aggressive following patients using urine testing, pill counts. And it's something that we have been working on for 2 years now in our clinic. I think that really what we've found is that we've been able to taper patients off of medications. We've been able to stop a lot of diversion. We catch people like that very frequently on a weekly basis. And we want to identify the patients who really need their medications, but put them on appropriate doses of medications, avoiding some of the things that will cause interactions and death. We had a 12-month period of time that we just looked back at. But we did not set this up as a research project. I think everybody has to understand that. But we went back and mined our data and looked at what we had done over the last 12 months. And some of the handouts that they're handing out show that over that 12-month period, we stopped 127 people, and it ended up being 8,500 pills a month. And so in this next year, we'll have 100,000 less pills coming out of our clinic. And it hasn't stopped. We continue to do this every week. And I would tell you, on the average week, we are stopping 2 more people. And so our goal is to take this program and to help other people start this program. We have a lot of interest from some of the clinics around us, including Centricare, which has been somebody that we're looking to partner with to spread this out, and, of course, looking at this as a pilot program. And I think that you have to look at this problem in a very simple manner. If your child is at home and they leave the bathtub on and it fills your basement with water, sure, you can send people down there and they can start bailing the water, but somebody has to go upstairs and turn the water off, okay? And that's what we're doing. The water in this case is the narcotics, and unless we stop that, I truly don't believe that this problem will ever change. And we're going to still be having one person a day dying in this state. Now, just to be clear, we still have to take care of the patients that are addicted. And that's the other part of our program in Little Falls. We went and also realized that we had to do something with the opioid addicts and the heroin addicts. And so Dr. Heather Bell will talk just briefly about our Suboxone program in Little Falls.
Hi, Dr. Bell, welcome. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and Committee. I'm Dr. Heather Bell. I'm a family doctor in Little Falls, Minnesota as well. We decided, obviously, like Dr. Devine said, that we needed to do something to help all these addicts, and so we both have our licenses to use Suboxone, the medically assisted treatment. We are two of just over 100 providers in our entire state, and we have two in Little Falls with our county, which is much smaller than a lot of the other counties. With our program, we have now touched almost 40 patients, and we have currently about 18 or 19 patients on Suboxone. Yes, we've touched that many, and not all of them are still on meds. I mean, we do have patients in jail. We have patients that have relapsed, but we also now have patients that, after almost a year of treating them, are being successful. They have jobs. They're back in the community. They're becoming gainful members of the society again, rather than continuing the cycle of in and out of jail, in and out of our hospital.
along with our Suboxone, the big part of the program and the big part of the program we want to make sure that the rest of the state jumps on board at is not just to give the medication. I mean, any doctor can go out and get their license and start writing the medication. But what we've done is created this program around it where they have to come in, they have to show us their urine, and we have to get urine testing. They also have to go to treatment. They have the whole group. They have to meet with their social worker. They have to get all the help they need, not just the medication to help them stop using their heroin or their opioids, but also to get them the treatment, whether that be inpatient or outpatient treatment and the social services that they need. Our state is severely lacking in providers that can do medically assisted therapy. And it's not a quick, here's your medications for 3 months, you're cured of your addiction. The studies show that if you stop your Suboxone within 4 to 5 years of starting it, you have an 86% chance relapse back to your heroin or your opioids. So this is more of a long-term. They always compare it to diabetes, which can get rather annoying when you're a primary doctor, but the reality is that's what it's become. We see these patients, I see some of them more often than I see my diabetic patients. And you have to kind of treat it like a chronic health issue, which is what it is, and treat them just like anybody else. And it is super important to have these patients, these addicts, these patients that just really need help to be part of a normal primary care clinic. They come to our clinic, no one knows where they're there. It's not like a methadone clinic where everyone there is an addict. They come in, they sit in our waiting rooms next to my OB patients and next to my elderly patients, and they're treated like everybody else. And now we've had some success of patients going out again and being active members of society.
Thank you, Dr. Bell. Is there anyone from the audience would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member questions. Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kreisha, thank you for bringing this as a bill, and we heard from you in the other committee, and you weren't even moving a bill at that time, but it was so impressive. I just think this is, you know, I think it's very Minnesota to have a team approach to things and bring communities together and say, let's kind of wrap our arms around these people and figure out what they need to help them recover and get our arms around this whole problem. And so I really like this idea, and I appreciate the work that you've done in your community, and I really hope that this can be something that can make a difference. I think this is just a very hopeful thing, so thank you very much for your work.
Thank you.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this question is for the doctors. I recall that 20 years ago this was sort of precipitated by the fact that there were a lot of people that weren't getting medications for pain, that doctors were not prescribing things. And I had a doctor that I could have a broken arm and he would tell me to go take an aspirin. How do we guard against the pendulum swinging back too far where people are in pain and unable to get medications they need?
You can talk about it. You were
at it
20 years ago?
Yeah, I was there 20 years ago. I think that, you know, that's...
Can you
that's
do
always,
Hauser?
I think that's always something that the patients fear. And I think that it's about responsible prescribing. And, you know, in the time that we've had this program, I've met with our orthopedists, I've met with different groups, because we still understand that people have pain, but when you look at chronic pain, there's very interesting things that come up, and that is that we know that there's certain doses, if you go beyond those doses, you get no more benefit, okay? And so the other issue with that is that sometimes if you mix these strong pain medications with other medications, people stop breathing. That's a problem. And so it's about responsible prescribing. It's about knowing that there's certain levels of pain medication that you responsibly can give and not have significant side effects. But I think that doctors are becoming more sensitive to that, and I don't think that people who truly have pain will be left to the wayside.
All right. Representative Kreisha, last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I would just leave it with the importance of this is it's working. We have a path forward. We have people that have replicable efforts that they can take those. If we can fund this, and I think the ROI on it's going to be fantastic, if we can fund this and keep this going, we're already hearing from other communities that want to participate. I believe we'll continue to build foundational support, and this is something that will continue to grow and we'll be able to put right into communities rather than them trying to figure it out from scratch. So I just think this is a great opportunity, and I would ask that we be included in the bill.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha, for a good bill. Representative, or excuse me, Dr. Devine, Dr. Bell, thanks for taking time away from your patients and for seeing patients in Minnesota. With that, House File 2140 is held over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Members, we are over. We're going to do one more bill. There's no capital investment after this today, but I understand if people need to scoop, but we're going to do Representative Zerwas. House File 808, try to squeeze in at least one more bill before coming back this evening. When we come back this evening, we're going to come back at 6:30 p.m., and we are going to go from there. Representative Zerwas moves House File 808 be held over for possible inclusion in our Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Representative Zerwas, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 808 is a bill that most people in the committee have seen. It's a bill that passed the House last year, but we had some last-minute fiscal note concerns. The bill will allow children on medical assistance who have uncontrolled seizures to get a drug classified as an investigational drug if all other therapies have been tried without success. The bill establishes a narrow exception with four conditions that must be met, must be medically necessary, only for those with specific medical diagnosis for which the drug has shown to be effective. All other treatments have been tried without success, and the treating neurologist has approval from the FDA to prescribe this drug. These children have Dravet's syndrome, a rare form of epilepsy. They will all have a letter from Dr. Worrell, a neurologist, director of the epilepsy program, and professor of neurology at the Mayo Clinic, which describes these children are at risk of brain damage and seizure-related death due to the uncontrolled seizures. Members, what we've seen in the last several years are children that are hospitalized with this condition. Right now, MA by law is prohibited from covering this drug. That leads these children's families to file a lawsuit against the Department of Human Services. That's happened multiple times over the last few years. In each of those times, those children's families have won. Over the last few times, the state has immediately settled that lawsuit and began delivering the strychnine drug, and it's been court-ordered to be covered by medical assistance. This bill would add strychnine in so that it would be covered, and two things wouldn't happen. One, we wouldn't force parents to sue the state of Minnesota for the only clinically proven treatment to take care of their kids, and two, we wouldn't accrue intensive care unit bills and prolonged time periods where these children are suffering and languishing in an intensive care unit while the legal proceedings undertake. Mr. Chairman, members, that's the bill. I plan on following up with the department on specific concerns around the fiscal note. The fiscal note is basically the identical fiscal note as we got last year. We've provided a lot of information that we think call into question the size of the fiscal note. We assume 16 patients next year, 16 children being going through this process. There's only two FDA-approved physicians in the state of Minnesota that can even prescribe this drug, and we have the patient numbers from those two physicians, and it doesn't come anywhere near that. So I'm going to continue to work with the department and hope that we can continue to lower the fiscal note. Mr. Chair, members, I don't have any testifiers, but I do have folks available to answer questions if need be.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Is there anybody from the audience who'd like to testify on behalf of this bill? Seeing none, any member questions? Representative Considine.
Not a question, but I talked to the lobbyist and she said there's a total of six.
Mr. Chair, members, over the last 2 years with the two providers that are FDA approved to dispense strychnine within the state of Minnesota, I think the combined over the last 2 years is six patients.
Thank you. Other questions? Seeing none, Representative Zerwas renews his motion, House File 808, be held over for possible inclusion in our Health and Human Services and Omnibus Bill. And it is held over. And members, we will be coming back here tonight, room 200 at 6:30. Ask members to leave the unused bill packets intact. They will be reused tonight. So if you could, just Seth, let me try to pick that up. See you all at 6:30. Thank you.
Health and Human Services Finance is reconvening. The hour being 7 o'clock. Welcome back, everyone. Representative Liu and I will move House File 2224 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Finance Omnibus Bill. I do not see any amendments, so with that, Representative Liu, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. House File 2224 really deals with the continuing situation that we have with the increasing for mental health services in our schools, but not all of our school districts or schools in general. This proposal will deal specifically with the very high needs in our intermediate districts and the service cooperatives that service our federal level 4 setting special education students. These are our highest need students where maybe the district of residence can no longer provide the services that these pupils need, and so they are sent to the intermediates for a very different and specified setting. And I've become increasingly aware and concerned of the high rates of special education needs, but also incidences of mental illness and mental health needs within these schools that are really being asked to serve really as both education and almost healthcare settings. So this would provide grants for mental health services for providers that would come into the schools, into these intermediate settings and the service cooperatives. And would help to make sure that we're better integrating mental health services into the school day and into the classroom. With me, if there's any questions, is Superintendent Sandra Lewandowski. She runs Intermediate District 287 in the western suburbs of the Twin Cities area. And I've had the pleasure of visiting 287 a number of times, and I think this is critical not only for supporting the amazing staff that work with the students in these schools, but also for the best interests of the families that are being served, the students being served, and also for the safety and well-being of our staff.
Ms. Lewandowski, welcome to the committee. Please just restate your name for the record, and I look forward to hearing your testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name is Sandra Lewandowski, and I'm the superintendent of Intermediate District 287. And I am grateful for the opportunity to talk to this committee. My school district has about 600 of the highest need kids in Hennepin County walking through our school doors every day. These are kids who in earlier decades would have been in residential treatment, but now are primarily the responsibility of the public schools. Last year I had over 300 staff injuries that occurred during my school year, and these are of the variety oftentimes of broken bones, sexual assaults. We increasingly are seeing sexualized behavior that are resulting in making the workplace even a different caliber of unsafe for our staff. Most importantly, though, we're trying to get the services close to the students and their families. These are students oftentimes who aren't able to get their kids into psychiatric help or certainly not into residential facilities. This grant would allow those services to be equally embedded into the school, so it makes the service, the mental health service, much more accessible for the kids and their families. With that, I'll open it up for questions.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for being here this evening. And education's not an area I'm completely familiar with. So just a couple questions. One is, in the bill it talks about federal instruction level 4 or higher. And I don't know. This is for or other service cooperatives under Minnesota Statute Section 123.8.21 that provide instruction to students in a setting of federal instruction level 4 or higher. I don't have any idea what that is. That's question number one. And the second, probably more important question is, we've heard some bills about school-linked mental health grants, and I just wonder if you could, if either of you could just orient me what the difference is here from what that program is doing.
Ms. Lewandowski?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, a federal level setting 4 is for students whose special education needs are so intense that they require a segregated school setting. So I have 5 buildings, for example, 5 schools where the students are coming and have no interaction with regular ed peers. Most of the time that's because of their behavior, the intensity of their behavior. In terms of the difference between school-linked mental health grants, what we envision is this being a more intense adaptive solution for students who we previously would have seen going to residential care. That's no longer happening many times for a variety of reasons, and we are trying to adapt to that reality where the services would come in and really be embedded oftentimes within the school and even into the classrooms, and that service provision being one where the education specialists are providing education, but the mental health providers who have those skills are providing that kind of treatment service to them.
Follow-up, Representative Lieberman?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. So I'm gathering from that this is something that is very much needed, but it doesn't. The two things don't replace each other. They're just for a different setting and a different level of need. That's correct?
Representative Loon.
Mr. Chair, and thank you. If I could just address and Representative Liebling. Yes, I mean, we do, and through this committee and the Omnibus Bill, fund School Link mental health grants for school districts. And I think virtually every school district, maybe say one or two in the entire state, is able to utilize that grant, and so it allows for outside providers to come in and provide some services to the school. I know I'm familiar with my own school district, and there's a private clinic where they have a counselor that comes in, like to the grade schools, on a certain number of hours a week to help out. This is a much more intensive concept and relegated specifically to the needs of these intermediates and service cooperatives for these very high-level, high-need special education students.
Thank you very much.
Any questions for the testifier? Is there anyone from the audience that would like to testify to the bill? Seeing none, final questions other than that? Representative Loon, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I know you have many, many wonderful and very worthy requests for funding. That I'll just leave you with a final plea that is, I am always astounded at the level of commitment and that of the service that's going on in these intermediate schools. And I can tell you without a question, they very, very much need this help. I am very concerned that we will have a disastrous situation that occurs at some point with staff if we don't get more assistance to help them with, again, these children with very, very intense needs and very mentally ill in many cases.
With that, Representative Loon, House Bill 2224 is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Baker. Representative Baker, I will move House Bill 1860 before us. I understand that there is an amendment to your bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, we will accept this amendment as posted to get it in the shape we need it to.
I will move the A1 amendment, and I note that there is just a minor correction. No? Okay. All right. Members, all those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. With that, Representative Baker, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House Bill 1860 talks about the only state hospital
that exists in the state of Minnesota that deals with the toughest of the toughest kids that have the most severe and acute needs with mental health. I'm really proud that we've got a hospital in Wilmer that has been around since 1965. And we have a staff that has done an amazing job there with some extremely difficult situations. We're the only state hospital for kids that deals with them in this level. Mr. Chair, tonight I have two testifiers that will just talk about that. I know we've got a long agenda, so I'm going to set aside, and this is just the programming money. We were able to delay potential closing of the cabs, and also we have a bonding bill and another bill, another committee that will be kind of alongside this, but we are getting ready for a reset, but this is for the programming dollars. So, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to some very awesome people. Thank you.
And I understand Ms. Laidlaw and Mr. Jensen Howard. So welcome to the committee. You can choose who goes first, just so we make sure that you get your name on the record and proceed with your testimony.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Barb Laidlaw, and I work as a mental health program assistant at Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Services Program, commonly referred to as CABS. I get to work directly with the kids. And I want to start by thanking Representative Baker for his leadership on this issue. Appreciate it. A few months ago, this committee heard testimony from Alethea Modlin, the mother of a child who phoned help at the CABS program. Alethea's son was born with severe autism, and there was a time when his violent outbursts became too much for her to handle. However, after a short visit to CABS, her son was able to return to his home, family, and school. Alethea's story is not unique, however. We routinely help families reconnect with their children. CABS is a safety net program. The children we care for are some of the most vulnerable youth in Minnesota. They exhibit behavior so extreme and dangerous that other treatment facilities turn them away. Most of the children we help have been sent to us from other treatment programs. We are their only hope. And there is hope. I could tell you story after story of the kids we've helped and the lives we've touched. Children who have been abused, neglected, exposed to chemicals before they were even born. Treated the way no child deserves to be treated. Kids who have experienced many failed placements and some who are wards of the state all find hope when they come to our program in Wilmer. Our talented team provides person-centered care to these kids, and we meet kids where they're at. And we help them achieve the best life they can live. It is very rewarding to see them learn and grow. I'm here to ask you to support the funding proposal to keep the CABS program operating. There's a waiting list to get into the CABS program, and this proposal will allow us to help more of the kids and families on that list. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for your time and consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Justin Howard. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm here also to support this bill. As the superintendent of the detention center here in Ramsey County, shortly before Christmas, we had a youth come to us after he had had a psychotic break. He committed a very violent offense. When he arrived to us, he was clearly very psychotic, not taking his medication. We could not get him into any hospitals. We had him civilly committed. It took us 4 weeks to get him into the CABS program. This is a program that is desperately needed in this state to take care of these very difficult kids who are not appropriate for a correctional system and where our traditional hospital settings in the community will not take them. They have the capacity and the ability and the staff to do this, and I hope that you support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for either of the testifiers tonight? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on the bill? Hearing none, Representative Baker, you have the final word.
Mr. Chair, members, I am so proud of this facility that it was probably one of the first things I fought for when I first became a legislator. And I've been on many tours. The building needs to be replaced, and there's a plan for that. We're going to help a lot more kids in the future, but we have such an amazing staff that are so dedicated. We've got kids that come back and want to be there for Christmas just because they have had such a connection with our staff. So with all that, I would wholeheartedly and appreciate your support for this CABS facility, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Baker, I'll renew my motion that House File 1860 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill for health finance.
Thank you.
As amended. Representative Zerwas, House File 1816. Representative Zerwas moves House File 1816 before the committee. Representative Zerwas, I don't see any amendments. So with that, do your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1816 is a community action grant. The community action grant will restore funding to 2003 funding levels, and the programs are designed to assist participants, including homeless individuals and families and seasonal farm workers and the elderly poor, to achieve increased self-sufficiency and greater participation in the affairs of the community by providing services and programs not sufficiently funded in the community by any other governmental unit. I do have a testifier here today, Mr. Chairman. We have Ramsey County Commissioner Blake Huffman is here to provide some testimony.
Mr. Huffman, welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record, and we look forward to hearing your testimony.
I'm actually going to start.
Oh, I have Bobby here, too.
My name is Bobby Benson, and I am the Deputy Director of Minnesota Community Action Partnership. We are the statewide association of the 24 community action agencies across Minnesota, and we cover all 87 counties. It's impossible to tell our entire story over the allotted time today, and even if we had several hours, it would still be very difficult. With that being the case, we have two witnesses here today who will be able to share some of the story with you, and they've both been involved for many years with Community Action. Before I do hand it over to them, I do want to say that part of the beauty of Community Action is the local control we're able to exercise. As we all know, different areas of Minnesota have different needs at different times, and they require different approaches. Community action agencies are flexible and able to apply different approaches to those. And in fact, no two community action agencies offer the same programs up and down. And we have a saying around the network that if you've met one community action agency, you've met one community action agency. So at this point, I just want to hand it off to one of our board members, the actual chairman of the board for Community Action Partnership of Ramsey and Washington County, County Commissioner Blake Huffman.
Thank you, Bobby.
Mr. Huffman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Blake Huffman is my name. I'm a Ramsey County Commissioner. I was elected about 4 years ago, and like all other county commissioners, we're assigned different boards to participate in. I was assigned CAPRW, the Community Action Partnership of Ramsey, Washington, and I'll be honest, I knew nothing about the organization. As I've been there now on the board for 4 years, I've learned several things, and starting with the simple pieces that it has a great economic impact to society. It has employs 300 people, or nearly 300 people. It has a unique way of leadership where a third of the board members are businessmen and women, a third are elected officials, and a third are members of the low-income community. So it has a unique style of doing things. But more importantly, it's an organization that I'm really excited about because it drives people towards self-sufficiency. Self-sufficiency is critical, and I know you support that. Four areas just really quickly to touch on related to that is education. So right now there's 1,900 children, over 1,900 children that go to the Head Start program, 0 to 5 years old. These are low-income families, and this education is helping them get to where they need to be so when they start school, they can be ready where they should be. Energy. Over 21,000 people last year received energy assistance. Another 100-plus received programming to help their houses get to become more energy sufficient so they can lower their energy bills. Certainly housing. There's over 360 families that were avoided homelessness because of the rent or mortgage assistance that we provided, and another 8,800 senior citizens that were able to stay in their houses and live independently because of assistance that we provided. And lastly, one of my favorite programs is transportation. We have a car loan program where we can actually lend money to people in Ramsey, low-income people in Ramsey, Washington County, so they can get a car and they can get to work. They get to school. They can do all the other things that you and I might do. To get that loan, they need to take financial assistance and classes. They need to become, once again, keep moving forward on the self-sufficiency scale. In closing, let me just tell you real briefly about one of our board members, Leandra. Leandra, several years ago, started coming to CAPRW as a user of our services. Over the years, she started joining our committees and eventually joined our board. And tomorrow night will be her last board meeting. She'll rotate off after 6 years. But the 6 years, so she has come from being a user of our services to one of our leaders and helping develop policy. And it's a great story of self-sufficiency. So I appreciate your time, and I hope you support this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record, and please present your testimony.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Patrick McFarland. I'm the executive director of Anoka County Community Action Program in Blaine, Minnesota. I started working with ACAP in 1973 and became the executive director in 1978. We would urge the committee to support H-File 1860, which restores the Plenty-era unallotments to the community action grants. And what I'm going to do is just go quickly through the handouts that were in your packet just to kind of highlight some things. The first handout is just some community action basics. Community action agencies originated under federal and state statutes. They're sponsored by a unit of government, primarily the counties, and designated by the governor. There's one CAP agency per geographic area. In Minnesota, we have 24 community action agencies that are 501c3s, nonprofits, and 11 tribal governments that are ICAPs. These programs are all designed for local control, local deeds, and local solutions, as the commissioner said. That makes, that with the tripartite boards and the way that CAPs are organized, that makes them one of the earliest and longest lasting public-private partnerships in the state. The second is a map of where the community action agencies are in Minnesota. Our Senate author has four CAP agencies and two ICAPs in his district. I see our chairman only has one CAP agency, but it's a very good CAP agency. The third is the total impact of community action funding, showing how it benefits greater Minnesota. This depicts how CAP agencies do a great job of leveraging funds back into their local communities. This is taken straight from their 990s, the most recent 990s. The yellow total is our statewide annual total, just under $300 million in the total system. The blue total shows the metro portion, $71 million, and the green remaining portion of $229 million shows the amount of funding leveraged back into greater Minnesota. The bottom line is that 76% of all CAP funds benefit greater Minnesota. I think we're going to move Anoka County Community Action to greater Minnesota. The fourth is a summary of the Community Action grant funding history, just so you can see the trajectory of the fundings and how it's impacted us with the unallotments. And the fifth is that it shows how the increased funding would be distributed by agency. In the short time that I have, we can't really talk about how each agency will use these fundings. However, federal and state law does require us to develop community needs assessment, develop a list of unmet needs, develop a strategic plan which prioritizes those activities. Under federal and state law, we're also required to have a measurable impact on poverty and must be unduplicated to other efforts, both public and private. Your local agencies can tell you exactly what you'll do with these funds if restored. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the support you and the committee have given to the CAPs over the years. And once again, I urge you to support H-File 1860.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Zerwas, do you have any other testifiers?
I do not.
Is there anyone from the audience that would like to testify on the bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member questions for the testifiers or the author of the bill. Seeing none, Representative Zerwas, you have the final say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. I think we I think most of us have connected with our community action programs in our district. I have TRICAP out of St. Cloud that comes down to serve the Sherburne County, Elk River area and do great work. And so thank you for hearing the bill, and I hope we're able to fund the program.
Thank you, Representative Ross. House File 1816 is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Representative Zuros, you have a number of bills up before us this evening. Just at your leisure, you can choose which one. We're going to be here a while.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I think we can do the, trying to find which one it is. I think we can do the competitive bidding.
House File 1739. Representative Zuros moves House File 1739 before the committee. There is an amendment. I believe Representative Backer is offering that amendment. Representative Backer, to your amendment.
Yeah, I would ask that we take the amendment after the testifiers. I have quite a few individuals from the district I represent that wants to testify on that amendment. Is that okay?
Sure. Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Representative Zuros.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I just briefly will say that I've worked with Representative Backer and I've worked with Mr. Lehman over the last several days. During all of that conversation, I have been unbelievably clear that my intent was not to keep the language in the bill impacting county-based purchasers as it is currently, that it was my wish to keep the bill in its form and lay it over and continue talks with DHS. But I gave my word to Representative Backer, and I gave my word to Mr. Lehman that the county-based purchaser language that they're uncomfortable with would not remain in the bill. That being said, I know a lot of people are here tonight at Representative Backer and Mr. Lehman's urging, and not wanting to keep people long, I don't see any point in dragging it out, so I'll take the A5 as a friendly amendment, and I'll take out the language earlier than I had intended, but still keeping my word to Mr. Lehman, as I had a couple days ago, and to Representative Backer that I did a few days ago. And so we can accept the A5 amendment as a friendly amendment. We can get on with the bill.
Okay, thank you.
I'll move the A5.
Representative Zuros moves the A5 amendment. All those in favor of adopting the A5 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? The A5 amendment is adopted to House File 1739. Representative Zuros, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. House File 1739 is the competitive bidding reform bill. In 2011, the legislature made a number of changes to how we procure the managed care contracts for BMAP and Minnesota Care. We moved to a system of competitive bidding these contracts as a way to bring additional savings to the state. DHS has gone through three major procurement cycles. The first one was for the metro area. The second one included 27 rural counties. And the most recent one in 2015 was the first time DHS procured the contracts statewide. After going through these cycles, I think it's important to take a look at how the procurement process worked, or in some instances, didn't work, and make some adjustments to the procedures for how the state procures contracts moving forward. I have Joel Uhland here from UCARE, who can give a little bit more background and do a brief walkthrough of the bill.
Mr. Uhland, welcome to the committee. If you could state your name and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joel Uhland. I am the Public Policy Director for UCARE. UCARE is a health plan in Minnesota that serves approximately 160,000 members throughout the state. I am here in support of House File 1739, and it is a result of some dramatic impacts that the competitive bidding process had back in 2015 into 2016. I think as we went through this, UCARE was a health plan that served 500,000 members at the end of 2015, and by the January 1st of 2016, we were serving 150,000 members. In one day, we lost 350,000 members. And we had a number of legislators that came to us on both sides of the aisle asking us for changes and what could be done to look at the competitive bidding process to make sure that there isn't such dramatic impacts for the members. Also, from a health plan perspective, it puts us in a situation where it's very difficult to be competitive when you're lose all those members in one day and are trying to be competitive for the future if there's other procurements that come around. So this bill is a result of a number of discussions with legislators, and let me just quickly walk you through it. Part of what we are doing here is that this would call for a regional approach for the state or for competitive bidding instead of the statewide approach that was used in 2015. It also clarifies the use of county board resolutions through this process. It clarifies the use of best and final offer and how the department utilizes that function. Part of what we are also looking at is having the department would be taking a look at the network adequacy and making sure that that is a function of the RFP process as well. There would be additional transparency in the scoring process as a result of this, and then we are also redirecting the appeals process to a contested case procedure rather than having the appeals process go back to the person who had made the original decision in the first place. We feel that this would be a more fair way to approach this type of an appeals process. And then finally, we also add an evaluation process as well, so that way as there is additional procurements into the future, there is a way to continue to do an evaluation process and to identify what works and what changes may need to be made. With that, I am happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Members, any questions for the testifier? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, so, Mr. Yulin, you started out, I think, saying something about how UCARE lost 300,000, I think you said, members in one day. And I guess I would ask you, I don't know if it's UCARE's choice to do competitive bidding at all, but given that we have a competitive bidding process, I'm not really understanding what would be the point of having competitive bidding if one plan can't win and another lose. So, I understand it's disruptive to, we're talking about big entities and a lot of clients, and I have to say, quite frankly, well, I don't think it's any secret that I'd like to see us not use managed care plans at all. We wouldn't have to do any bidding, right? But I know that's not where you are, and that's not what we're talking about now. But, what is the point of having bidding if then you don't replace one plan with another?
Mr. Euler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I think part of the way that we are trying to approach this bill is to go towards a regional approach. And the reason why we are looking at a regional approach to this was so that way you don't run into a situation like we did a few years ago where it's a winner-takes-all type of situation. And the thought process with that is that, so let's say that you have a rotating version of this, and each region is up every few years, and it would be up to the department to determine how many regions there should be, and so on. But I think as we would look at that, if, for example, UCARE lost in one particular year for a region, it isn't completely devastating to the health plans to the point that we're not able to compete, especially if that is not procured again for another 4 or 5 years. And I think, one of the things that we've continued to hear from legislators is that they want to see more competition. They want to see more health plan options available in Minnesota and not be just limited to the ones we have. The net effect of what happened with this last competitive bidding process was it made it very difficult for us to continue to be competitive because the only county that we were able to continue to serve after going through that appeals process was Homestead County.
Representative Brunig.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, thanks for your testimony. Yeah, the concern a little bit is if we try to force counties
to do a competitive bidding versus allowing them to decide to do a competitive bidding. How do you stand on that?
Mr. Euland.
Well, I think that in the last committee hearing there was a change that was made. We were looking to actually have, at least from UCARE's position, our original intent was that we would like the commissioner to have flexibility on whether they do competitive bidding or not. So if you look at, I think it's on line 1.9, it says the commissioner shall utilize a competitive bidding process. As introduced, the bill was may utilize a competitive bidding process. I think from our perspective, we would prefer that it be may. It should be up to the commissioner to decide if they want to utilize that type of a process or not.
Follow up, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I guess from my standpoint, I like as much local control as possible. And for the commissioner to just, whether Mayor Shell to dictate to local county officials on this would be very concerning to me going forward. Okay, thank you.
Representative Helderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Euland, I think that we need to obviously do some work with regard to this competitive bidding process. I think that people in public programs have really been on a wild ride the past few years. And I think that, in my mind, the goal is to create more stability, I think, for members first and foremost, because I think it's really hard for people not to know what's going to happen next and next year. And so in your mind, or perhaps the author, how does this answer that question, or does this answer this question in terms of can we stop the Mr. Toad's Wild Ride of coverage?
Mr. Euland?
Mr. Chair and Representative Halverson, I think that that's part of the reason why we are looking at the regional approach is that you're not going to see the dramatic shifts. It's not to say that there wouldn't be shifts after each competitive bidding process. I would anticipate that there would be. But, you know, I think that the goal would be is that rather than have the one statewide shift, that, frankly, you know, even 18 months later, we're still feeling the ramifications from, you know, as to how that resulted in this. If you have it split up more so that there's more regions across the state, you're not going to see such dramatic shifts to the number of members and the members that are being served, so that hopefully you get into a situation where you'd have one region that would be procured, and then that region would hopefully stay still with wherever, you know, whoever was the winners or losers for a good 4 to 5 year period. I mean, the state does require that this has to be re-procured every 5 years. But, you know, in our minds, it would be something that hopefully once you establish that, it's good for a good period of time.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ross.
And I think, Representative Alderson, you kind of keyed in on one of the big issues as we've seen over the last few years. Hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans year after year seeing some of these large changes. And with, I think with Medica not renewing, we see another huge shift. And that was, you know, let's be honest about that. That was as a result of competitive bidding where they felt that it was winner take all and they had to bid as low as possible. And there was a lot of pressure to bid low and they bid too low. And that meant they couldn't renew. So, and that was hundreds of thousands of people, again, upended. And so my hope is by doing this regionally, we don't have that high-stakes poker game where the pot is the entire state. And it's kind of everyone's at the brink, and it can be phased. It can be easier, quite frankly, for DHS to not do the entire state at once. And the other option, the other components, when we look at the appeals process, I mean, to think that when some of the larger systems lost huge territories, in order for them to appeal, they had to go back to each individual county and ask the county boards to appeal on their behalf. They couldn't even file the appeal. And it's less, it's for some counties, that's kind of a burden to put on them. Then, if you do get a county board to appeal on your behalf, you appeal back to the commissioner that just decided against you. And so we didn't think that made much sense either. And so I think there's a lot of things that are worth looking into from kind of looking at it as a regional approach, the timing of it to the appeals process and how it goes forward.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Zerwas, just kind of following up on what you were saying about the hundreds of thousands of people that have been bounced around, and then last year we had three counties that had absolutely no options for health care. We now have 25 counties that have stepped up, taken the burden, are doing a great job with their co-op health programs. I see this as something that will cut into the work that they have done and maybe even sabotage it, and I'm wondering why we would do that.
Representative.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Constein, to be clear, we had the A5 amendment, so that addresses that issue. So,
Representative Considine.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. No, I don't believe it totally does. It is better, but I'm still concerned that the counties that have stepped up and taken on this burden and, in fact, have improved health care in their counties, Representative Grunhagen's is one of them, that it will jeopardize their future with this. And if you want, I'll talk to you offline if you'd like why I feel about that.
Representative Ross.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I've received numerous indications from DHS that they're planning on rebidding again in 2019. So, rebidding is likely happening in 2019. That means planning will start in 2018, which means if we want any reforms, we have to do them this year. Now, you can say that you don't want to reform the system and go to rebid, but I don't think that's the right way to go.
Rebuttal? Representative Considine.
Yeah, that is what I'm saying, is that for those 25 counties that have stepped up, taken care of the problem, I don't think that we're looking at reform, we're looking at creating new problems. So, that's exactly, I guess, what I'm saying is I don't want to rebid. I think they have worked really hard, they've done a great job, and I don't want to see their work jeopardized.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Zerwas.
DHS has indicated to me that they're going to rebid in 2019. There is nothing in state statute currently that would prevent them from doing another statewide rebidding and do exactly what you say doesn't want to happen. So the only way to prevent happening what you say you absolutely don't want to happen is to look at rebidding reforms, competitive bidding reforms. It's the only way you can guarantee it is if we come back to the final bill after negotiating with DHS that puts in regions or some other approach. There's nothing currently in state law that would prevent DHS from doing a statewide competitive bid in 2019. They've indicated to me that they plan on doing competitive bidding in 2019.
Representative Lockhart.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do support going to regional or sub-regional bidding something smaller than statewide. And for those of you who weren't here, I remember it was this week that the proposal was brought in by DHS, not even as a bill, as an amendment to go to statewide bidding. The people who were running the program at that time are no longer with DHS. They've moved on to other positions. I went to the audience, and the counties, the health plans, no one had been talked to about that in advance, knew what it meant, what it would mean in terms of structuring the program. It was all a grand experiment, and because they said there would be savings with it, of course, and it was one of those years with the consolidated finance committee in the second year of the biennium, they went along with it, because if you say savings in HHS, of course it's going to go forward. But in the end, I don't know that we were well served in terms of being able to have enough attention to what the unique issues are in each part of the state. I have heard complaints from, I believe, multiple credible people that the process was not done in a standardized competitive bid basis where the same information is shared with all bidders at the same time. And I can tell you that even just doing a competitive bid within the metro area, the first one that was done 20 years after we started this program, it was hard for the seven metro counties to agree on what were the big problems that the health plans ought to tackle, because the inner ring county said they're not taking charge of TB, and our public health people are going crazy chasing it all over because they're not following up. And so, you know, some doctors don't get trained on it much because they think it's an ancient disease. But collar counties wanted to talk about, we don't have enough specialists in our geography. How are you going to open up offices in our area? And so even to get the seven counties to agree on, you know, programmatically what we want was difficult. And I think that by going to statewide bidding, all the focus was on money. And we've always said it's cost and quality, it's value. And yet I think that it's really hard to get to that value discussion when you're looking at networks across all the state and being able to weigh out the positions. So I think that we need to seriously think about what kind of a bidding process we want, and I hope DHS will consult with us before they get too far along in defining that. But I do think that the experiment on statewide wasn't successful in terms of bringing out the best and making sure that it's, and the results we've had right now of 300,000 people having to change health plans a year ago, and then now again this year, another 300,000 having to change health plans, means that we don't have continuity of care. We haven't really served the people who enroll in this program or the providers who've established relationships with them. And so I think we do need to look at some reforms, and I'm glad that this is a starting point for discussion.
Representative Murphy E.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of other things for you to consider, Representative Zaras.
I bet I can help, too, if you want to.
It is not uncommon for people in employer-based coverage to have to switch providers as their employers renegotiate their health coverage, right? So that is not an uncommon experience for us. And yet the idea of people in public programs having to switch at the magnitude of what we're describing still is troubling to me. And when I think back to the news stories of the Medica succeeding with the bid and UCare losing the bid, I think about the two different entities, UCare and Medica, and what they offer to their enrollees. And there is some significant difference in the way that they approach providing coverage for people in public programs. And when I think about the bidding process, it seems to me that we maybe would want to be more descriptive or set some different expectations, knowing that the population being cared for, the population in the public programs generally have challenges, more disease burden, et cetera. And if the bidding process is largely about money, we might miss the fact that some of the things that we would want to see in that process aren't being included in the bidding process. So I don't know, you know, I've only worked once on an issue about competitive bidding. It was for school employees, pretty successful so far. Representative Davids and I did that together. But I would just want to say to you and to Mr. Euland and others that maybe we should be thinking through more about the population being served here to make sure if we're going to go continue down this path of competitive bidding, that the bidding process is reflective of the needs of the population, so we do a better job of serving them. Thanks.
Response, Representative Roth.
Thank you.
Representative Leland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I think that DHS might disagree. They might perhaps speak for themselves, but I don't think that the process was, however the outcome came out, I don't think it was intended to be all about money, and I think that there were quality measures that were at least intended to be built into it. So some members have said that it was really all about money, and I don't agree with that. But a couple things. One is, speaking of money, I don't see a fiscal note. I don't know if there is one here, but there certainly ought to be. Does staff know if we have a fiscal note?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, there's a pending fiscal note. This is a pretty complex issue, and DHS felt probably there was going to be some changes to this, so it won't be ready for a little while.
Okay, well,
Representative Liebling.
Chair, well, thank you. I think the fiscal note for this is a very important piece, and it's really hard to discuss this properly without that. I would like to hear from DHS on this issue, but as far as the fiscal note, something I would just really love to understand better is how much this whole bidding process is costing in terms of just the management end of it. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, goes to what these changes, how that would change it, too. So I'm really interested in that. And I don't disagree with you that regional, if we're going to do this, that doing it by regions is probably better. So, I think that piece of it, I might be able to agree with you on, but I really would like to understand what DHS's response is to this, if there's anybody here that would care to come down, because Representative Zerwas, you mentioned about negotiating with DHS, and I don't know when, I bet that's probably ongoing, but I think that negotiation should be something that we all have an idea of what is involved in it and not have it just go behind closed doors someplace. And so I would really like to hear from Ms. Marquardt, all the pieces, if you could really speak to all of this so we get a full understanding of where the department sees issues or not.
Ms. Marquardt, welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and respond to Representative Leland's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Julie Marquardt. I'm with the Department of Human Services. In response to the different sections or the different provisions that are here, I think I would say that we have had a lot of discussions post-statewide competitive bid with counties in particular, and I think we would agree that doing statewide was taxing for us. It was taxing for the counties. It was a lot of work, and probably we wouldn't recommend that we do it again statewide. So I don't think that we disagree that statewide is probably not the way to go. I'm not sure that that setting out a requirement for a specific number of geographic regions and having that set here and not having some flexibility is necessarily the way to go. We also have this would require actually us to do competitive price bidding in every county, and one of the aspects of the last competitive bid was that where a county had a county-based purchasing plan, they were actually not required to submit a competitive price bid for medical assistance. They were required to submit one for Minnesota Care. So that would be a change from how we did this before. And, I think we'd want to think about what that means to those entities because it is a little bit different when those entities are competing on price versus a very large health plan. The combination of the amendment, which sets out the definition of rural counties, but leaving in metropolitan statistical areas and requirements around those, there's a conflict there that I think we'd have to work out because there are rural counties that still have the designation of being part of a metropolitan statistical area. I do think we would welcome the clarification around the county board resolution.
and scoring that as part of our consideration. There was confusion about what that particular component meant. We do have concerns about dictating, you know, a best and final offer and offering it to every responder. Typically, when you do a procurement of any kind, you generally are not required to give an offer of a best and final offer to everybody who responds. You may target it to what you think your, three best choices are, and you may want to look at what those are because you've already narrowed the field. To simply require the best and final offer to everybody may not get us the competitive results that we're looking for. Network adequacy, we don't disagree that doing the best job we can on evaluating the sufficiency of the networks for the people being served, we would not have an issue with that. Giving the data to a responder before we execute contracts, that data is actually classified under Chapter 13 as being not public data. I think we would want to think long and hard about when, if you provide data to a responder and yet you haven't executed a contract with anybody, what that does when you're trying to finish negotiations if with any of those parties who may get that information, because you don't always end up with your first choice response. Sometimes you do have to move to the second or third ranked person, and so you end up with somebody having information that they wouldn't normally have had. I think one of the biggest concerns is moving this to an appeal. Right now, the county is the one who holds the appeal right, and there's a process involving mediation that is laid out for them. This actually creates a right for a vendor responding to an RFP that no other vendor has currently in the state when they don't get a bid. So to open this up with what would be a lengthy process, we would have to build this now in, considering that it's likely that somebody who didn't get selected is likely to utilize this, that we would have to actually build this into the timeline for our procurements, which would draw them out much longer, and there's likely to be a cost associated with these. So I think that's kind of an overview of some of the feedback that we've had related to this. The evaluation that we did do an evaluation actually after, I believe it was the 2014 competitive bid, and we contracted with SHADEC to complete that. They interviewed counties, and so that's not an unfamiliar process, and it could be accommodated.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much, and, you know, I'm sure we have a lot to get through tonight, and Mr. Chair, I guess I would just ask, I think this is this is a big deal. And this one is one of the bills that we're hearing that is a lot of money. You know, we have a lot of stuff go across our desks that's relatively little money. This is really, really big money. And so and I know we're under deadline, but I would sure like to have the fiscal note and have us be able to discuss whatever's in it. You know, I'm just a little nervous about just this gets laid over and then, you know, we see it in the omnibus bill maybe and, you know, we're not able to really discuss it in the context of seeing what the actual cost of doing this is. And I think everybody understands there are a lot of moving parts here, which I'm just wondering if it would be, you know, what the chair's plan is for this, because, I know that Representative Zerwas, as he does very well, is going to be working to try to work out some of these kinks. But I'd really like the committee to still be part of it as it, you know, before it gets really far along.
Any response from you, Carter?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, yeah, I agree. I think we're going to continue to work with DHS. I think we've heard from members around some consensus around some of the issues. I think there's concern with some of the other issues. I think there'll be a meeting with representative from the counties and the plans, and I think there's no doubt that there's a lot more work to do. But what I will say is I think there are some base reforms that we can move forward yet this year to be in play for 2018 as the department might be setting up for competitive bidding in 2019. What I don't want to do is set up a group to study this for a while and put it out for a slow, painful death. I think there's a lot we can agree on. I think there's a lot we can get to in the time we have remaining. There's some really good reforms that are best for Minnesota.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not suggesting that we send it off to a study group. I just really would have liked to have had the fiscal note so that, because this, as I say, this is really big money, and I don't have a really any sense of how much cost there is in the bidding process in all of that. And I would really like to understand that before we just pass along. And is this going to be laid over, Mr.
This will be laid over, Representative Lee.
So I don't know. I guess if we, I guess I would ask you, Representative Zerwas, to kind of keep us informed, and maybe Ms. Marquardt too, because this is big stuff. And then, you know, maybe when we do the markup of the omnibus bill, to perhaps expect some discussion around this if there's still issues. Because,
I would expect,
you know, this is one where it would behoove us to spend our time.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Chair. I know you need to move on, but just wanted to make a point to, I guess, in support or clarify what Representative Considine said and Representative Murphy, that there's a lot of value in this county-based purchasing, and I think you agree with that. And we all are saying there needs to be some reforms in the procurement process. But I would hope that you make sure all stakeholders are at the table. And in addition, look at the unique benefits that the counties provide and provide some weighting to those things. And I don't want to belabor those, but some explicit weighting to how they integrate with public health in the counties and do things like have connectors and those types of services that really benefit the users. So thank you for that.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Ms. Marquardt. Representative Zerwas, so there would need to be a number of reforms prior to 19 if we were, say, to exempt the 25 counties. What would we have to do?
Ms. Marquardt.
Mr. Chair, if the question is, I guess I should clarify that we have actually not said or committed to a procurement in 2019. I think what we have said is that's the earliest that we would initiate any additional procurement. So just to be clear about what I know to have been said. At the next procurement, whenever that is, if someone's coming forward with a timeline for procurement and there is a desire to exempt, it simply would have to provide a timeline for when identify those 25 counties and then the timeline for when they would be procured and the manner in which they would be procured, so that we're still complying with the five-year requirements for procurement under state law, or how we're going to navigate that. If it's going to go longer than that, we would need certainly to get some sort of exception from that.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you. You have 25 counties that are doing the right thing and providing great service. I just don't see messing that up. Thank you.
Further questions from the members? Seeing none, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, work continues.
That said, House File 1739, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair, members, I move House File 1819
Representative Zerwas moves House File 1819 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. We have the bill before us. Representative Zerwas, to your bill.
Mr. Chair and members, House File 1819 is legislation that will bring the state of Minnesota into compliance with the covered outpatient drugs final rule released last January of 2016 by the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services for changes to pharmacy reimbursement. Minnesota must submit our state plan amendment to CMS by the required June 30th deadline. I'll now have Brian Carr from the Minnesota Realtors talk about the process and the policy included in the bill in a little bit more detail.
Mr. Carr, I didn't know that you changed your association. I think you're with the Retailers Association, are you not?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Is that what I said?
You said Realtors.
Oh, Retailers. Detail House.
It's a common mistake. It's a common mistake. I forget, Representative.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Carr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Brian Carr. I represent the Minnesota Retailers Association. We're a statewide trade association representing small, Main Street, regional, and national retailers. I am here with specificity on this legislation representing our chain pharmacy retailers as well as our independent pharmacy members, which includes single-store Main Street businesses and pharmacies in greater Minnesota, to voice our support for House File 1819. Mr. Chair and members, in January of 2016, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, issued the covered outpatient drugs final rule, implementing significant changes to pharmacy reimbursement for both brand and generic drugs dispensed to our Medicaid population. Although I defer to DHS for the exceedingly complex details comprising the CMS final rule, I will share two very broad strokes of what the CMS final rule means for our retail pharmacy members operating in Minnesota, and why House File 1819 is required in timely fashion. First, the CMS final rule requires pharmacy reimbursement for drug products to be changed from an estimated acquisition cost methodology to an actual acquisition cost methodology. As implied by the name, pharmacies will make no profit on products. This will result in reduced reimbursement for our retail pharmacies. That said, the CMS final rule also requires states to reimburse pharmacies for their cost to dispense drug products. This is known as the professional dispensing fee. Just as with the actual cost of product, the professional dispensing fee is now required to be cost-based. DHS used survey data to propose a new professional dispensing fee that complies with CMS final rule. The proposed professional dispensing fee will result in increased reimbursement for our retail pharmacies in Minnesota. There are budget ramifications for these required reimbursement changes, which, as the fiscal note indicates, which should be in your packets, members, would be approximately $3.8 million in FY 2018 and $3.7 million in FY 2019. This is just to remain at the current level of service that our pharmacies are able to provide to the Medicaid population. However, before we can address even those budgetary impacts, we need to update our statutes to reflect the new requirements for the actual acquisition cost methodology and professional dispensing fee, as I explained. Our current statutory language will be out of compliance as of April 1st. Fortunately, much of the hard work has already been done. DHS met with pharmacy stakeholders in a very transparent fashion starting last January and over the summer, and we appreciate them. And we want to thank them for the job that they did in meeting with stakeholders. Finally, members, House File 1819 is a necessary step in a larger process for complying with the CMS final rule. We ask your support to move this process forward. For your back pocket, taken together in summary, product reimbursement will go down for retail pharmacy members in Minnesota, and the professional dispensing fee will go up, members. Thank you for listening to my testimony.
Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify to the bill? Members, any discussion? Seeing none, Representative Zerwas, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. I'll renew my motion.
Representative Zerwas renews his motion for House File 1819 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Thank you, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you.
You have two left, Representative Zerwas. Play your hand.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll move House File 526.
Representative Zerwas moves House File 526 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. We have the bill before us. I see no amendments to your bill.
Mr. Chair, members, House File 526 is to establish a Board of Occupational Therapy. Occupational therapy in Minnesota has been regulated by the Minnesota Department of Health since 1996. Decisions about scope of practice, ethical practice, and continued competency for occupational therapy are made by MDH staff who are not occupational therapy practitioners. MDH staff meet with an advisory committee about three times a year. The seven-member committee has two occupational therapists, two occupational therapy assistants, a medical professional, and two public members. There are nearly 5,000 licensed occupational therapists, practitioners in Minnesota today. Until 2016, the Department of Health has collected fees that exceed the cost of delivering the program. At one point, the excess was so large that the Department of Health came to the legislature and passed a bill that included a two-year moratorium on collecting fees. The Department of Health had enough excess funds in the Occupational Therapy Licensure Fund to run the program without collecting any fees. Over $750,000 of fees collected by MDH have been used for other purposes than regulating the profession since the year 2006. We've also experienced occupational therapy. Practitioners have also experienced some delays in licensure and renewals. Because occupational therapy does not have its own board, it has been in the past excluded from legislation intended to apply to all licensed health professionals listed in Minnesota Statute 214. An example for that would be the bill that called for shortening the statute of limitations for health care malpractice claims from 6 years to 2 years was broadly written to cover professions and boards that were listed in 214. The bill then did not list the Department of Health, and so occupational therapy were not included. And so the bill is to move the licensing requirement out of the Department of Health and set up an occupational therapy board. There is no opposition at this time that I'm aware of. The Department of Health is okay with the move as well. We do have one testifier, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Sure. I am Dr. Karen Sames with the Minnesota Occupational Therapy Association, and I'm happy to testify on this bill. Representative Zerwas has given most of my testimony for me, so I'll keep this really brief. What we're proposing is a new board that would have 11 members. There would be five occupational therapists, three occupational therapy assistants, and three public members. Two of the public members would be people who have been recipients of occupational therapy services and or family members of someone who has, and one health professional licensed in Minnesota. We are the largest occupation regulated by the Department of Health, largest health occupation, with our nearly 5,000 practitioners. So in order to move this forward, it would put us on a par with the way occupational therapy is regulated in 40 other states by having our own board. It would be consistent with the way we regulate other health professions in Minnesota, including physicians, physical therapists, physician assistants, chiropractors, etc. And it would create more accountability for our profession by our profession. So I urge your support of House File 526. Thank you.
Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on the bill? Seeing none, members, questions for the testifier or the author? Seeing Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have no problem with this, generally speaking, and think it's fine, but I just was noticing that the board that is being set up is has on it three occupational therapy assistants. So could you talk about that a little bit? That seems, why would you put occupational therapy assistants on the board for occupational therapists.
Dr. Sames.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, currently both occupational therapists and occupational therapy assistants are regulated by the Department of Health. We're, both levels of the profession are licensed in Minnesota, and so we feel that if they're being licensed, they should be represented on the board.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. So I guess I missed that. So they're under this as well.
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
Final comments, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, as I said before, there's no opposition to this, and I'll renew my motion.
Representative Zerwas renews his motion for House File 526 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Thank you for your testimony, Dr. Sims. Representative Zerwas, House File 1383.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. House Bill 1383 includes two components. There's the brain injury expansion.
Representative Zerwas, let's move the bill.
I'll move the bill, Mr. Chair.
And then you're moving to have it be laid over for possible inclusion?
That is the motion, yes.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Speaker your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. The bill has two vital components. It has a brain injury expansion. Fetal alcohol spectrum disorder is a medical diagnosis that encompasses a wide range of conditions caused by prenatal alcohol exposure. The most adverse outcome of this exposure is the impact of the alcohol on the developing brain and the resulting brain injury. Currently, people who have fetal alcohol syndrome disorder cannot qualify for the brain injury waiver because the language specifically excludes those who have acquired their brain injury before birth. The first part of this bill would eliminate that barrier and allow people with FASD, when they meet the criteria, to be considered for a brain injury waiver. The second component of the bill is a prevention program expansion. And each year, over 7,000 babies are born who have had some level of prenatal alcohol exposure. Some of these babies have moms who are struggling with addiction and substance abuse disorders. A very successful pilot program in Homestead County was supported in 2013 to address the challenges of these families. In 2015, a modest increase was approved to expand the program to two more locations. This program not only supports pregnant women and mothers, it also supports the children in the family. The result of this program, which includes for mom and baby at birth, testing for mom and baby at birth and randomly throughout the program, have been stellar. In 1 6-month reporting period in 2016, the program served 99 women and 101 children at the average cost of $1,500 per family. There was one baby that tested positive for marijuana at birth in this group of clients. And so you see, the prevention program was vastly successful. We're proposing a $500,000 increase to expand the program to three more areas within Minnesota that are currently underserved. Mr. Chair and members, I do have one testifier on this bill.
Well, welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Sarah Messel, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 1383. As Representative Zerwas said, FASD is often misunderstood, and there's oftentimes a misconception that FASD is a mental health condition. However, it is a medical condition, and the thing we worry about the most is the brain injury that occurs because of the prenatal exposure to alcohol. So it is our recommendation that the language is changed to make brain injury services available to people with an FASD when appropriate. It's important to share with you that the Minnesota Brain Injury Alliance and the Coalition for Citizens with Disabilities are in support of your legislation. And as Representative Zerwas said, the second part of the legislation is seeking to expand the funding for CRAFT
Community Resources Aiding Families in Transition Prevention Program that is so highly successful in Olmsted County, being replicated in Minneapolis and Pine City. I had the opportunity to meet a young woman named Amanda who came to the CRAFT program on a referral from her case manager at a halfway house. Amanda was 22, was 3 months pregnant, and had just completed 1 month of inpatient CD treatment. Her four-year-old daughter was in foster care and was only allowed supervised visits with her. When she came to CRAFT, she had a desire to stay clean and sober, have a healthy baby, and be reunited with her oldest child. She needed this long-term support, and in the time she's been with the program, she delivered a toxic-free baby. She was reunited with her older daughter. She's maintained her sobriety. She's found and maintained her own apartment, is employed part-time, and is starting a local community college with the goal of becoming an LPN. She's built a life for herself and her children, and now volunteers to mentor new moms. This is just one example of the outcomes of this program. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you, and I urge you to support this common sense legislation that will help many fellow Minnesotans.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify to this bill? Seeing none, we'll go to member questions. Representative Considine.
Well, thank you, and I'll try to make this my last comment of the evening. Representative Zerowas, thank you for bringing this forward. As a lot of you know, I worked in locked institutions, and the last 5 years or so came to realize that a significant portion of my clients at the Blue Earth County Jail suffered from fetal alcohol syndrome. And once I realized that, so much of the behavior made sense. You'd look at them and go, why'd you do that? I don't know. Poor impulse control, lack of planning. Guys would leave the jail with the best of intentions and then be back in a couple of months, and it just didn't make sense until I started applying this. Did I hear you say there's a test, though, now? Because last time I knew there was no testing. I didn't think so. But again, I really appreciate you bringing forward this. It really is needed.
Hearing no question.
Nope.
Final word, Representative Zerowas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. The child plays no role in having this brain injury. And so clearly to have an artificial, arbitrary barrier that would prevent them from services seems just cruel. And so I hope we're able to include this in the final bill. And with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'll renew my motion.
Representative Zerowas renews his motion for House File 1383 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Chair Dean, you would be next. Chair Dean, you have three bills before the committee tonight. Which one would you like to hear first?
What are you eating out of the whole cup?
Mr. Chair, members, I move House File 237 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. I also have author's amendment DE4-1, which I would like to introduce and discuss at this time.
Representative Chair Dean moves the DE4 amendment -1.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This bill was heard in policy, I believe, last week. This amendment is a result of discussions between providers and DHS staff on the most effective model to move and implement this coordination payment for integrative health care populations. This amendment makes some technical changes to the earlier version of the bill and also provides some technical cleanup terminology for care delivery systems and integrated health partnerships. This bill would direct DHS to develop care coordination payments and process to bill those services effective in 2018. The IHP has invested heavily into care coordination models in all aspects of care for statewide health coverage programs. And we see this as a possible way to get significant savings down the road. With me to discuss this is Buck McAlpin from North Memorial, who's been at this a while.
Mr. McAlpin, welcome back to the committee. You can state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, Buck McAlpin on behalf of North Memorial. I think Representative Dean kind of hit it on the head. We work from the policy committee through with DHS on taking some stuff out of here to make it more workable. And not just a North Memorial pilot like our original bill, but to include all 21 of the integrated health partnerships and how they can all participate in that moving forward and pay for things that we're currently paying for up front on the healthcare system side around care coordination, community paramedics, and things that we all do to capture some of the savings the state's been able to realize.
Discussion to the amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the 237DE4-1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. To your bill as amended, Chair Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would like to direct members to the fiscal note, and it's the cost. There's sort of a rectangle, a heavier black rectangle around the cost, and there's it's in thousands, so that's $34,089,000. The little brackets around that are actually savings, so that's what we're going to want to see a few more of these.
Yeah,
it's like a little smiley face right there. So we're going to want to see a few more of those. We'd appreciate those. As we're coming in, and to be very serious about Mr. McAlpin and North have been very active in care coordination, stuck their neck out a few years ago with CCDS trial with HCMC and Regions at that time, and really have tried to be innovative and taken some risks in doing that, and we see this is potentially a real way that we can save some costs down the road, and hopefully with some favorable decisions from Washington, D.C., this could actually be represent even larger savings regionally or statewide.
Amen. Anyone in the audience that would wish to testify to the bill? Seeing none, members, questions for the author or the testifier? Seeing none, Chair Dean, final word.
Appreciate your support.
Chair Dean, you renew your motion.
Renew my motion.
For House File 237 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill, as amended.
That is correct.
Thank you. House File 1517, Chair Dean?
I'll move House File 1517 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
There is an author's amendment, I see.
There is an author's amendment. That is the A3-1. I'll move the A3-1 author's amendment.
Chair Dean moves the 1517 A3-1 amendment to your amendment, Chair Dean.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, this deals with the awkwardly acronymed State Quality Reporting and Measurement System, or SQRMS. What that does, this is intended to align Minnesota's quality measurements with the federal requirements. This continues the Minnesota State Quality Reporting System measurement, but reduces the administrative burden for clinics that will now be required to report on both systems. Currently, SQRMS requires clinics to report 19 different quality measures, of which only three overlap with the 271 quality measures identified by the Medicare program. House File 1517 requires that the Department of Health work with stakeholders to choose from those 271 measures. It limits the number of measures to no more than six for a single specialty clinic and 10 for multi-specialty clinics. Six is the number of measured that is required under Medicare program. So this provides a little bit more flexibility within the amendment. Also, we have some folks from MMA, Ms. Silversmith, and I think I saw Mr. Renner skulking around here earlier as well, so they may be available to answer more technical questions if members have them.
Square me.
Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Janet Silversmith. I'm with the Minnesota Medical Association. I'm actually here just to answer questions if anyone has any. The MMA strongly supports this legislation. We think it's a significant opportunity to reduce the administrative burden facing a lot of medical practices. It aligns with the quality measures used by hospitals, which are already conformed with Medicare. So we welcome your support, and I can answer any questions.
Any questions for Ms. Silversmith? Seeing none, are there any others that wish to testify to the amendment? Welcome to the committee, Mr. Griffin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Chairman Dean, my name is Phil Griffin. I represent Minnesota Community Measurement. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you this evening, and I'll try to be brief to the amendment. As we look at the amendment, we believe that it makes a change that will do away with one of the quality measurements that we've used, which is a patient satisfaction amendment, something that has been one of the most widely used by people visiting the website that Minnesota Community Measurement has up for patients. I've spoken with Representative Dean briefly. We have an amendment that we're working with him on, and I hope that as this is laid over that we'll have the opportunity to work and amend this as we move forward. I appreciate the opportunity to speak this evening, and I won't take any more of your time. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for the testifier? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Griffin, so patient satisfaction. So it just occurs to me this is something we've been talking about a lot lately in terms of the opioid issue and pain and how providers deal with pain, and that sometimes the suggestion is made that too much of a patient satisfaction measure can be involved with the idea that the provider is supposed to, you know, take care of everything for you, and that this might be kind of part of our problem that we're having with overprescribing of opioids. So I don't know if those things are related here at all, and maybe Representative Dean has a comment on that, but it, you know, I haven't given this bill a ton of thought, but it just occurs to me that if we're getting rid of a measure like that, it might in fact be a good thing. If, now I get that, you know, patient satisfaction is important and it could cover a whole lot of measures, a whole lot of different issues, but maybe you could just speak to that a little bit more about what's in that.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Griffin,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I won't speak in detail to it, but it's not just a measure that says, I like my doctor, I don't like my doctor. It goes into some detail about the experience that the patient has had. It probably should be called the patient experience measure rather than patient satisfaction measure, but I'd be happy to share details with that offline with you, Representative Liebling and others.
Okay. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling, I agree with you. I think within patient satisfaction surveys, they differ from place to place. But one of the things that is within patient satisfaction surveys is pain. And they are looking at those right now, and they're trying to address that and change that from, the question is frequently, are you pain-free? And the expectation is that you don't have pain. But if you're like my friend Representative Erdahl and you're 64 and a half years old and you get a knee surgery, you're going to have pain. And that's going to be part of the situation. And so the patient satisfaction surveys do ask that, and how you ask that as opposed to are you comfortable or can you manage or can you do what you need to do to get through the day. The question, are you pain-free, is probably not a realistic one that we should be pursuing. And I know that Representative Baker has a bill addressing just specifically that. that we're going to be looking at, I'm sure, very shortly.
Mr. Chairman, it's the 62-year-old who just got his knee replaced. I'm with Representative Dean. He's and Representative Rudall and I had ours done on the same day.
Any further discussion to the amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor of adopting the A3-1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A3-1 amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chair Dean, to your bill as amended.
Appreciate your support.
Any questions? Hearing none, Representative Dean renews his motion that House File 1517 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Finally, last bill is House File 641. I would move that House File 641 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill.
Chair Dean, I see there is an amendment.
Yes, there is, Mr. Chair. At this time, I would like to move the A1 Author's Amendment.
Chair Dean moves the A1 Author's Amendment. All those in favor of adopting the A1 Amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A1 Amendment is adopted. Two-year bill as amended. Chair Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill has two parts. First, clarify that with NHCMC that surcharges do not apply to supplemental payments made to hospitals that have a high volume of Medicaid patients. HCMC receives supplemental payments. Two, repeal of the intergovernmental pay model by HCMC to DHS from which they do not benefit financially but are rather penalized. Further, the amendment asks for an eight-year phase-out of the managed care supplement payment. The federal government allows a 10-year phase-out of this payment, but in spirit of compromise with DHS, what they're requesting is a shorter period. That, in a nutshell, is the bill and the amendment as a clarification. We also do have folks from HCMC to answer questions about this. It is a rather technical payment correction. See that we do have some folks here that can answer questions regarding that. Ms. Berglund is here, who I actually asked to draw a picture for me to describe exactly how this works, and she was nice enough to actually draw that for me, which many of you know is a quicker way for me to get what's going on. So she was able to do that. I don't know that she can do that for all of you, but I'm sure you would probably not need the picture, but she can answer any technical questions.
Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify to the bill? Seeing none, questions for the author of the bill? Seeing none, Chair. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's so technical that the fiscal note is upside down. Just saying.
Chair Dean, you get the final word.
Appreciate your support.
Representative Dean renews his motion for House File 641 as amended to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. As amended. Thank you, Chair Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
He's the chair. Members, we are adjourned.